Yeah, we actually
want to show me. That's fine.
Hi, Janice. Thanks. Oh, it was okay. She's very active in this county. And her family is from Boston. And her parents have away now. And so they're doing some kind of online interpretation. Which isn't quite know how to go about it. Thank you. So she can call you or email you or whatever. Thank you. Oh, in Sussex.
Good morning. I'd like to call this 31st meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection Planning Council to order. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County. I ask the other members of the council to introduce themselves.
Janice Kovach, councilman in the town of Clinton.
Good morning. Glenn Vitrano, Sussex County Freeholder.
Mimi Letts, Persephone.
Kurt Olstead, Chester Township Public Member.
Jack Shire, Morris County Freeholder.
Debbie Pascarelli, Greenwich Township, Warren County Representative. Tracy Carluccio, East Amwell Township, Hunterdon County Public Member.
Elizabeth Calabrese, Bergen County Freeholder.
Tim Dillingham, I'm a public member. I live in Mercer County.
We have a quorum present. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
This meeting has been advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act and was further publicized on the council's website. I want to report on a number of items. I'd say for members of the public, there is an agenda and other material that will be discussed at this meeting available on the table in the reception area. This was obviously an unusual month in New Jersey state government, and in a number of respects, the council staff labored under a number of unusual circumstances, including the state shutdown and also the loss of power in this building, I think several times, and, from the weather. So I would like to commend the staff for weather, I should say, for going through that and particularly those members of the staff who came in during the time when the state was shut down and essentially volunteered their time to be here in those days. We have some good news in terms of staffing, which Dante will go into in more detail, but we have now filled all the vacancies on the council staff. Some of those people have started. The rest will be starting over the next several weeks. We've also been able to borrow several staff members from the Department of Environmental Protection who are, some of them are here and some will be coming, who will be helping us with the work. And Dante can go into that more. In the eventual passage of a state budget for the current fiscal year, the Highlands Council did very well. The budget we had proposed was essentially adopted intact in the state budget. So we will have adequate funds to do our work over the next year, and we'd also like to commend Dante and others on the staff who watched over that during the weeks of the budget discussion to help that continue to stay the way it was.
Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to approve the minutes.
Okay.
Are you in a hurry yet?
Prior meeting.
Okay. Do that. We have the minutes from the last meeting. Is there a A second?
I'll second that.
I just wanted to get that out.
Okay, all right. Any comments or revisions? Or?
I have several corrections. Okay. I just mentioned to the chairman I had insomnia last night and went back to the office to work, and I read the minutes real carefully this time, as unfortunately come with that, so I have some comments on it, actually, all seriously. There are, on page 2, a reference to comments that I made, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The biggest change is on the second line that refers to Highlands Act exemptions. It really was the word regulations. If I may, I would actually like to read what the corrected paragraph should read, and I have this typed up to give Diane. Ms. Pascarelli advised that she attended a June 12th meeting with council staff in Warren County where the Highlands Act regulations were discussed with municipal zoning and construction officials. The meeting was conducted by Larry Beyer of NJDEP and was very instructive, informative, and productive. She noted it was collectively concluded at the meeting that there was still a long way to go in ensuring that the right information get out to folks making decisions. Okay. The next paragraph, also on page 2, again, I had to restructure it a little bit to convey that what I sort of thought I said and tried to communicate, and I'll read that paragraph as well. Ms. Pascarelli also noted that she attended a meeting in Hunterdon County on June 12, 2006, between local officials and the Office of Smart Growth. The not-so-good news was that representations were made about policy decisions involving the council with regard to the State Planning Act, plan endorsement, cross-acceptance, and that she could not confirm these representations when questioned by attendees. She noted that this issue should be added to an upcoming meeting agenda as soon as possible. And page 7, second to the last paragraph, this is related to the Alpha 519, and I just want to clarify that I actually did not make a statement at the time. I think this revised paragraph. Thank you, Denise, for picking it up, that I had stepped down. But Ms. Pascarelli stepped down from the council as public comments were offered pertaining to Alpha 519. At a previous meeting, she'd announced that she had prior involvement related to this project during her service as a public official for Greenwich Township, and that she was recusing herself from the Alpha 519 matter. And one other minor one on page 9, second paragraph. I had a lot to say in that meeting, so I have corrections here. The first line, I would ask that it read, Ms. Pascarelli asked whether an extension for insert providing comments on continuing the Sussex plan insert endorsement application. I understood what we read here, but I think for the public that would just clarify it. And that is all my comments.
Do you accept them as to make any motion?
Yes.
Okay. Who seconded this one?
Second.
So I assume you accept these comments?
Yes.
Okay. Any other changes? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay.
Okay.
So we don't have quite enough members to approve the minutes with three abstentions. Okay. So we'll approve them next time. We have 10 members present and 8 members of the quorum. Okay, now it's time for the chairman's report. The only other thing I wanted to mention is, as you all know, there are 3 vacancies on the council. The governor has not yet nominated anyone to any of those seats, but there is, I gather, a possibility that will happen soon. I think that's what I've said at each meeting, but I mean it each time. And our next scheduled meeting is August 17th at 10th. Do other council members have items to bring up at this time?
I have one item which just came to my attention. I'm staring at a sign. A gentleman in the front row sitting behind a sign that I find extremely offensive, and I would ask that the sign be removed from this meeting with me.
If you don't understand what you're doing to these people,
if you don't understand it, sir, then I can't explain it to you. But I wish
I can understand it. You're taking these people's livelihood, sir.
Whatever you suggest, you can say in words. I would not like to see that sign facing me, please. And I would hope that you get it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
I have a sign too. Does that offend you?
No.
I hope it does.
No, I can't read it.
No.
I hope for the best of it.
Would you like to see the sign that I'm referring to?
Yeah.
For the record, it's a Nazi swastika.
There are some lines that should not be crossed, and that's one of them.
I say it's an Indian symbol.
Excuse me, we're not open to the public.
Other comments? Dante, executive director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The chairman is quite correct that we have some good news in terms of our staffing level. Is Anthony Cortese here? If you'd stand up, please. Anthony has started working with us full-time. Anthony has an economics and a planning background and has already done great work for us through our graduate studies program. We've been able to bring him on full-time. He's now part of our planning staff. Thanks, Anthony. In addition, we have gotten an acceptance for the position of Director of Government Affairs and Operations. It's a position that will really help us. We have, due to our staff shortage, been unable to do quite as much outreach as we would have wanted to our stakeholders and to others, and we want to be able to address that. We have a really terrific person who's accepted. She also has good management experience, and she's going to bring that experience to bear, hopefully at the end of August, to work with our administrative, our operations staff. We also have, we are waiting on an acceptance for an offer we've given for our coordinator of grants and outreach. This is another pivotal position for us. We have grant funds under the statute that are available to municipalities and counties that's in furtherance of the development of the regional master plan, and it will, going forward, help towns as they work with us on developing the regional master plan and then also conforming to it. As we move past the adoption of the regional master plan, we have a really terrific person in mind, someone with a planning background who has a wealth of experience in grants. She should be ideal for not only the grants part of the job, but also the outreach function. We're hoping that we get our acceptance back shortly so that she also will be able to join us in a matter of several weeks. And we think that will really help complement a terrific staff that we've been able to put together. The staff, as the chairman said, showed a really terrific commitment. Well, they do every day, but a particular commitment when the government shutdown came around because the staff essentially wanted to come in and just keep working anyway. It's a testament to their belief that this regional master plan is really important. It's not important just as a statutory obligation, but it's something that's really beneficial for the residents, beneficial for the region, and for the citizens of New Jersey, because they want it to be the best possible plan that we can make it. And so I'm really very happy that we have a couple of folks who will be joining us, and the staff is really doing a terrific job, and I want everyone here today to know that. In terms of getting the plan done, it remains an ambitious challenge. We have gotten some help from agencies, as I've indicated in previous remarks at previous meetings. The DEP has now told us that they will allow five full-time folks to work with us. These are folks who are very experienced in important technical areas that will benefit us in development of the plan. Given that we aren't able to hire as many folks as we would like, and because we are committed to do a good job on the plan, these additional folks are going to help us, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that we plug them in a way that tries to keep us on our schedule. Our website has a tremendous response. We are getting thousands of hits each month. By way of example, in the month of June, we got almost 50,000 hits. So that's almost 1,600 hits a day. And it's not surprising to us on the staff that almost everybody who goes onto the site not only checks out information generally about the Act, the Council, but goes to the document releases. And that's very gratifying to us because we have gotten a lot of preliminary information, technical information, out onto the web for the specific purpose of making sure that everyone can see what we're doing, why we're doing it, and can be fully engaged in the process. For members, we have some other statistics that are in your packets. You'll note that we get statistics each month on our web hits and web usage, and we use this to tailor the way we put information up and to double-check that folks are able to access everything. And by all accounts, public is very interested in what we're putting out there. A little bit more on the preliminary technical releases. As members of the public will recall, back in June, the council authorized us to release preliminary technical information. Since that time, we've released about a dozen different documents. These documents go to such topics as groundwater capacity and use, surface water resources, groundwater availability, forest integrity, TDR sending and receiving, redevelopment potential, potential regional growth areas, brownfields, known contaminated sites, historic, economic indicators, and financial impact assessment. We have other data layers that we are sharing with our fellow state agencies who are also charged with coordinating with us in the Highlands region. Once we get those reviewed documents back, we will be posting those as well. We've created a place on the website at the upper right-hand corner, which is specifically for public releases of information. I think as a testament to 50,000 hits in June, the public clearly is able to find that and to get onto that site. And we think that's going to be very helpful in the process as we continue to roll out the data on the plan. One final note, the Garden State Preservation Trust has been a source of, you know, once leveraged several billion dollars in funding for preservation in New Jersey. That preservation is both of open space and farmland. Unfortunately, our 10 years is coming to an end. There's a sunset provision in the Act in 2009. This council has gone on record multiple times saying that we absolutely need adequate funding, and we need it specifically for the Highlands. I was able to attend a stakeholders meeting that was organized by the governor's office that included representatives from all of the major state agencies and included members of grassroots organizations, county and town representatives. The purpose was to pull together the best recommendations for the governor so that the administration can lead an effort to get renewed funding. The timetable for everyone's information is that in about 60 days, the administration hopes to have recommendations flow up from that group through the cabinet members so that the governor can figure out how we can go about coming up with a stable source of funding. Preliminary thought of the group would be to have an initiative on the ballot in 2007, but none of the specifics really have been made at this point. The staff will remain involved in the discussions in making sure that we further the council's interest in making sure that we have adequate funding. The council has passed resolution in the past on the importance of having funding here for the Highlands region for various purposes. And it may be the case, Mr. Chairman, in the future, we recommend another resolution as we get closer to an action date. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to commend Dante and the entire staff for continuing to work over the past weeks when we were going through a difficult time in the state and doing their best to make sure that we fulfill our mission of having a quality R&P done by this year.
Thank you. Committee reports, the Plan Development Committee was going to meet this morning, and due to the power outage Friday, the public notice about the committee meeting never went out, so we did not meet. So we will reschedule that meeting probably sometime before the next council meeting in August. Presentation of public release of the preliminary technical information. Back to Dante and Steve. And if you could just, I know we haven't received many, maybe I can just say this, but so far the public comments we've received on the technical information we've posted, I believe we have received just a handful of comments.
Correct. Some of them have been excellent from a variety of stakeholder groups, and we received some from the general public. And we are addressing those comments as we continue to develop the plan.
And we will be reporting back on those, Mr. Chairman. It's a matter of pulling together the numbers and summaries, and we will have that hopefully for the next meeting.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, is there some way that we could be informed as to the type of questions and comments that are coming back
The intent is staff will compile the comments and report them in the packages to the council periodically, so that you'll at least have understanding of what the public's perception is to the information that we're releasing.
And that would be good to get by the next meeting.
Yes.
And also, who is reviewing it? I mean, we want as much review as we can get of this.
Steve, did you want to proceed with the, we have two different things we want to share with members today that are important topics that have been the subject of our public releases.
Certainly, thank you, Dante. The staff and a series of contractors that are working to support the staff is reducing a great volume of information to help inform subsequent policy decisions that will be necessary by the council. Those policy decisions will essentially paint the picture ultimately of the Highlands' future will look like, both to address the underlying intent and purpose of the Act, which is to ensure the sustained protection of the natural and ecological values of the region with primary focus on water supply, and also do that in a manner that allows the council to encourage economic development opportunities where they are consistent with and compatible with those resource protection goals. We're going to present results. They are the results of the technical reports that have been released to the public, to the council, just as an indication of the type of information that will be presented to the council moving forward towards completing the draft regional master plan, and give you a flavor of things to come. We've intentionally picked two separate technical reports. One is reflects a resource a constraint analysis that is focused on drinking water and what is necessary to protect those drinking water supplies, not only to meet human need now or protect the drinking water supplies for our existing communities and families, but also for future generations of residents, not only within the Highlands region, but outside the Highlands region, that derive their water that originates from within our region. But also to maintain ecological process, that that frequently human need exceeds natural systems' capacity human need exceeds a natural system's capacity to maintain ecological function. And when ecological function is compromised, our ability to sustain human need is also put at risk. So the intent of the plan is to find that balance where a human need can be addressed and satisfied without compromising ecological function and process. And in doing so, that is what I believe is truly intended by the meaning of sustainability, that you balance both needs. With groundwater capacity, which is the basis of the presentation that Otto Zabetka from the USGS will do, is tries to determine how much of our groundwater supplies are available for both consumptive, human consumptive, and ecological use. The decision the council will have to make moving forward is deciding how much of that water the council is willing to dedicate towards future consumptive use, and that's a challenging question to answer. And it's been a very complex analysis that we've gone through to try to give the council the information that's necessary to come up with a informed and highly defensible basis to make that decision. In the end, the information Otto is presenting capacity information. That's total volume of water that's in the system that leaves groundwater and feeds surface water supplies. And the concept is generally that as we draw groundwater out of the system and we consume it, it is lost from the system, that it depletes the flows within streams. And at some point, that depletion of flows within stream has irreversible consequences on ecological processes that are necessary to meet human needs. So by evaluating the relationship between the amount of water used or withdrawn from groundwater and its effect on stream flow, we could have a better understanding of where the limits to sustainability are. How much water can we reasonably withdraw from groundwater without risking ecological process and compromising our ability to sustain human need? So with that, I'm going to introduce it to Otto, and he will go through the methodologies and processes that the USGS used to help inform that decision, to help estimate that capacity. It doesn't give all the answers, but it certainly reduces a lot of complex science to information that can help inform that decision that the council will make during the month, coming months. Otto?
Thanks, Steve.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the air conditioning, too. The last time I last time I did one of these for the full council was in the school down the street, and it was like the hottest day of the year, and the air conditioning was off. but anyway, as Steve said, this is essentially an overview of a technical memorandum we produced for the regional master plan. And it's an overview of the data, the methods, and some of the results.
You get air, but no.
Right. Okay. So it's just the up button, right?
Yeah, we're right.
Right. Okay. Okay. So the main objective of this water capacity assessment is to identify the capacity of Highlands watersheds to meet current and future water supply demands, particularly for public supply needs, while also looking at stream habitat and trying to preserve ecological health. Okay, what do we need to know? We need to know how much water is continually being supplied to the groundwater system, how it's moving through that system, and how much is discharging to streams, and how much water is and will be used for human consumption, and where that water is being used. Okay, why focus on groundwater? Well, groundwater is sort of the hidden resource. It's not easy getting a photograph of groundwater, but you've seen this. You've driven past road cuts on 287 or to the New York Thruway. And here we have the water. This is groundwater seeping through of fractured rock aquifers. We're focusing on groundwater because it's the primary drinking water source for Highlands communities. And I believe there's about 117 million gallons a day of groundwater that is withdrawn from Highlands aquifers. And also, groundwater is the critical component of stream flow, as we will see. What do we need to do? Okay, we need to evaluate on a regional basis the amount of water per watershed under a given set of climatic and ecological conditions. And we also need to take into account existing and projected water withdrawals to identify watershed capacity. And we're trying to do this regionally because we want to define areas that are water rich, water poor, water more, water less, what basins might be more stressed than others, sort of opportunity and constraints type of mapping. Okay, so we're doing this in a watershed type analysis, and we're looking at 183 of these HUC-14 drainage basins. HUC is a hydrologic unit code, and they're actually sub-watersheds, and they're outlined there. You can see the preservation and planning area. The area in blue are where these watersheds are outside the boundary, but somewhere they do intersect, so we went out to the full watershed in this analysis. And these drainage basins range in size from 3 to 21 square miles in area. And our analysis is a sort of a comprehensive examination of stream low flow statistics in combination with the physical characteristics of the region's watersheds, the geology, the climate, the recharge, the basin, size, shape, slope. And also, where a large part of this analysis is a comprehensive look at groundwater use throughout the Highlands. Okay, a few concepts. We're going to talk. Yep.
Can you just spend 1 minute explaining why the focus on low flow statistics for public?
Well, I think you're going to see that in the coming slides. I think that's what this is about here. That's what we're talking about with respect to stream-based flow. This stream-based flow is groundwater discharge, and 75% of the stream flow is in the highlands is groundwater discharge. And the amount of base flow in a stream is a measure of the yield of the underlying aquifer and a measure of the stream's ability to sustain flow. Base flow is also the amount of precipitation, the infiltration capacity of the soil, and how the aquifer can store and transmit water to these streams. And this would be under natural conditions. And then we can talk about stream flow depletion. Groundwater and surface water, they're sort of a single resource. And what we see here, we're adding a well, a pumping well to our system, and we're changing the hydraulic gradient. The well withdrawals intercept part of that groundwater discharge to streams. And pumping will divert discharge or induce flow from the streams. Taking water out of the streams isn't really going to affect groundwater availability because that groundwater has already, it's the amount of flow that has already gotten to the stream. Okay, this is a bar graph of 80 years of record at the PQuest at PQuest stream gauge. And what it's showing is a comparison of total annual precipitation to the amount of stream flow over a period of 80 years. And the upper set of skyscrapers there is precipitation, and you can see it generally averages around 45 inches a year, and half of that is stream discharge. The other half goes away through evapotranspiration, or evaporation from surfaces, transpiration through the leaves of trees. So you lose 50% of that precipitation. What's important here is when we're looking at total stream discharge, the area shown in blue within the bars is the stream low flow, or base flow, and you can see that it's consistently in this particular basin makes up something like 80% of the stream flow, but you can see how it varies annually based on precipitation, and because of the variability, the climatic variability with respect to the stream discharge, we're looking at base flow recurrence intervals, and what this is it represents a range of climatic conditions from wet would be the 2-year recurrence interval to dry. So for each of the gauge basins that we looked at, we developed low flow statistics for the 2, 5, 10, 25, and 50-year annual intervals. And what they represent, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a cyclic occurrence. It doesn't mean the 5-year is going to occur every 5 years or the 10-year base flow amount is going to occur every 10 years. It's a probability. So, for example, the 2-year annual base flow occurs at 50% of the time, and the 25-year base flow can occur, there's a 4% probability of that occurring every year. And this is how it sort of lines up when you're looking at these recurrence intervals with respect to mean base flow for a particular, this is a particular gauging station. I believe this is also the PQuest at PQuest. It's a very sort of a large basin here, and what we're seeing is the recurrence intervals with respect to mean base flow and mean base flow for the drought of record. And what we see here is now we're beginning to set up thresholds or how much we can begin to start talking about capacity, because if you were looking at water capacity with respect to the 2-year recurrence interval, you could say that based on this, you would have 80 million gallons per day capacity within that particular large watershed. Whereas if you go down to the drought of record, which is about 50 million gallons a day, and you can see the 10 and 25 sort of bracket that. And that's why in this analysis we really focused on that, because if you want to protect the resource, you want to protect to at least to the drought of record, or to our driest known period.
Question. Sure. The drought of record, that's what time frame?
I think that was in the 60s. You can see it there, 1966, 62, 66 in there. Okay. And then we also used another method. It's called the low flow margin of safety method. And this is a method developed by the New Jersey Geological Survey. And it's an ecologically based approach that protects stream low flows, and it uses a margin between two stream low flow statistics. It looks at the lowest traditional low flow condition, which is the 7Q10, or the lowest flow over a 7-day period, seven consecutive days during a 10-year period. It also looks at a critical flow regime for aquatic ecology, and that is the lowest monthly flow that generally occurs in New Jersey during the month of September. And up in the upper right here, we have a little bar graph that shows the monthly median flows, and you can see that, of course, July, August, September are generally the lowest months with respect to stream flow. And what we're doing here is we're taking the difference between this September median flow value and the 7Q10. And what we're saying is that, here's 100% of the margin. But the question is, so if this is capacity or the amount of capacity per basin at 100% of the margin, do you want to give that up? You probably don't. What you do is you apply a percentage. It's sort of a safety net. So, for example, if our September median flow is 37 million gallons a day in this particular basin, and the 7Q10 is 12, you subtract that. That is your low flow, 100% of the low flow margin, which would be about 25 million gallons a day. And by applying this percentage or this low flow margin of safety, here we used 50% as an example, that would give you a capacity of 12 million gallons a day. And from that, then you would subtract some consumptive withdrawal, whether it be monthly max or just total consumptive use or consumptive use at full allocation. A decision would have to be made there. But using the 50% low flow margin, the low flow margin of safety would be 6 million gallons a day as a estimated capacity for this particular basin.
I don't know if I could. So the issue of the low flow is from a drinking water capacity planning perspective, you plan to the worst case scenario during drought periods when the water is least available. You don't want to plan for good times when there's a lot of water and then find out for 2 weeks during the summer there's no water coming out of the tap. So that's why we look at low flow to establish capacity limits on consumptive demands, which is human use. So the number that comes out of this is a conservative estimate of how much water can be withdrawn from the system and still provide water during those critical dry periods and not impair stream flow or ecological health of streams. That can be converted within the area of analysis, the HUC-14, into a population carrying capacity, or how many people or future demands can be added to our existing uses of land and not exceed that capacity threshold. So that could be people per square mile, it could be equated to number of residential units per acre, or square footage of commercial or industrial uses within that area. So this informs the land use capability map in establishing what are the capacity limits to future growth throughout the region, based upon limitations in water supply only.
Okay, and just talking about how conservative this method is compared to the base flow recurrence interval method that we discussed previously, you can see that the September median flow is essentially lower or less than the 50-year recurrence interval. And the 7Q10, of course, is our lowest flow. And what we're saying here is that in this particular basin, if you used 100% of the low flow margin, there would be essentially 20 million gallons a day available. And you can see how that sets up with the 25, which would be about 45 million gallons a day, and then 10, which is somewhere over 50. Okay, so where does the data come from? It comes from our surface water gauging stations. And you've probably seen these along streams. These are our continuous record stations. And what it is essentially a stilling well connected to the stream. And there's a recorder in here and a float that bobs up and down with respect to the water surface. And the water level in the stream, but by knowing the water level in the stream, you're also knowing the amount of discharge, or you can calculate the amount of discharge in a particular stream. And these stations, I think they record every 15 minutes. In addition to that, we also have 96 low-flow partial record stations, and this is where you would have a person make a series of measurements over a period of time, maybe 8 to 12 measurements over a period of a number of years. And what we're able to do is what this thing, this is called a pygmy meter, and it has a propeller on it, and the woman here is counting the beeps. And by the number of beeps, they're able to convert that into a flow rate for the stream. And so these are very expensive to maintain and build and operate and maintain. This allows us to get obtain data from with a greater distribution at a less expensive rate. And this is a map showing you the distribution of these gauges. The black triangles are the continuous gauges, and the red triangles are 96 low-flow sites. And what we're able to do is correlate the low-flow, the red triangles, to index stations, the black triangles. So we're able to develop the low-flow statistics using those base and gauged gauging stations. And the part of this exercise is also to determine or outline data gaps. And yeah, is it perfect? We have data that we're able to use now. Yeah, more data is better. This is the best that we have available. But as I said, part of the exercise was to determine other areas where we could upload existing gauges, or where we can fill in with to get additional data in the future. And the gauges that we selected, there are more gauges out there, but we wanted to select those that were unregulated, no dams or reservoirs. We didn't want anything affecting the data that, or corrupting the data that we were collecting. And we selected sites with minimal withdrawals upstream and minimal sewage returns. Continuous gauge had to have 20 years of quality record. The low flow station, a minimum of 8 measurements over a period of 4 years. And of all 96, that averaged to 22 measurements over about 30 years. We'll just blow through this. This is low flow statistics computed for the gauged basins. We used several USGS programs. The first one is called the PARC computer program, and what that does is it separates the groundwater or base flow from runoff, and you can see this is a stream flow hydrograph, and these are the peaks, and the peaks are essentially surface water runoff, the other component of stream flow. And what this program does is automatically separates the two components for us. And then we have a couple other programs that are used to compute the 7Q10 and the September median stream flows. And this USGS MOVE-1 program is the one that relates the low flow statistics from partial record station to those continuous gauged stations. So we did all this analysis for the gauged basins, those 121 gauged basins that varied in size from less than a square mile to 157 square miles. But now we have to focus in on our HUC-14s. We used two methods, and these essentially are all ungauged basins. There may be a handful of them that HUC-14s that matched our continuous or partial record basin. But the first method we used is called the drainage area ratio method, and it assumes that stream flow in an ungauged basin is the same per unit area as a nearby gauged basin. And the requirement is that it had to be on the same stream, and that the ratio of the ungauged basin area to the gauged basin area had to be within a range of 0.3 to 1.5. Using this method, we were able to get 53 of the 183 HUC-14s, or obtain the develop the low flow statistics. And just to show you how this is calculated, Here's your gauged basin, the USGS gauging station down here at the bottom. The area of the gauged basin is about 16 square miles. The 7Q10 that we developed for that was 0.22 million gallons a day. So now you want to define this area, and the area is 8 square miles, and the drainage area ratio. So you divide the 8 square miles by the 16 square miles, and you come up with the ratio is 0.49, and you times that times your low flow statistic, and you come up with 0.11 MGD for your smaller HUC-14.
I could add, one of the challenging aspects of developing a regional plan is there are data gaps. And the council has gone through a significant effort to ensure that whatever information informs the plan, it is consistent throughout the entire region, so that you don't present in the end a plan that has huge holes in it that then doesn't allow informed decision making at the municipal level. So a lot of this effort that USGS went through with the information that's available on limited areas and defensively apply that across the entire region.
Okay. Estimating low flow statistics for ungauged basins, part two. So, as I said, we could define the low flow statistics for 53 of the 183 basins using that drainage area ratio method. For the rest, we had to look in detail at the particular physical characteristics of each of the basins, not only the gauged basins, but we also had to do that for each of the 183 HUC-14 sub-watersheds. And what we did is we looked in detail at the drainage area, the percent and area of land use, land cover, impervious surface, geology, channel slope, channel length, mean basin slope, climate, and recharge. And we tried to relate the low flow statistics to this to these basin characteristics, and this was done through regression analysis, and not to bore you, but we used these regression equations came up with a regression equation for each of the low flow statistics, the 7Q10, the 10 and 25 year recurrence interval, the September median flow. And essentially what we found is that some of the major characteristics of the basins in the highlands that affected our low flow stats is, of course, drainage area is always the number one factor, but we also saw that recharge to the groundwater system was significant. The basin slope was a significant factor, and also the area of glacial aquifer. Okay, and this graph is just comparing discharge in million gallons per day per square mile, that's the up and down factor there, against all of those 183 HUC 14 watersheds, just to give you an idea of how the capacity or the water capacity might vary over each HUC 14 or regionally. And you can see the 10 and 25 year base flow interval up here, generally ranging between 40 MGD to 0.55 MGD as an average, and you can see again how conservative the low flow margin capacities are. Their median value is probably is 0.15 million gallons per day. And if you looked at that in comparison to mean annual base flow, the 10-year base flow is somewhere about 65% of mean annual base flow. The 25 is about 55% of mean annual base flow, whereas the low flow margin is about 22% of mean annual base flow.
So, Otto, does that graph describe that there's a lot of variability in the observations of the HUCs throughout the region, or is it, can you characterize it that way in terms of what you're saying?
There's variability, and that's actually coming up here. We could see the aerial variability on these maps that we've produced. So these are the water capacity maps at 100% with no percentage given in for safety, base flow 10, base flow 25, year recurrence interval, and a low flow margin. You can see the comparison. The range here is from 0.01 million gallons a day per square mile to greater than 0.75 million gallons per day per square mile. And the reason for a lot of this, these darker areas, are these are the areas of greatest groundwater recharge, greatest precipitation, generally falls in this area of the highlands. There are some basins that continually show up that are slightly have less capacity than others. They're generally the smaller basins. They're generally the basins with the steeper slopes, where you would get more runoff, less base flow, less flow to groundwater flow to streams. Just go on. Another major facet that we looked at with respect to the water capacity analysis is groundwater use. And these are a set of maps. This is 2003 groundwater use based on Bureau of Water Allocation permitted data, and purveyors, if you have large capacity wells over 100,000 gallons per day, you have to report your diversions to DEP on a quarterly basis. We compiled this data for 2003, did extensive QA analysis on it. This also incorporates domestic well use. It's actually 1999 domestic well use, which essentially was our best data set. But what we're showing here is the map on the upper left is consumptive groundwater use. By consumptive, we mean that we'll start off with this one's total groundwater use, and consumptive is that which is evaporated. It's or doesn't get back to the nearby environment. And what we see is that the total groundwater use is 117 million gallons a day. Consumptive use is 14.7 million gallons a day. And then we also looked at consumptive use, maximum monthly consumptive use, and consumptive use at full allocation. And you can see how it varies at full allocation. Currently, it would be 31.4 million gallons a day. And there are ranges of consumptive use. For example, if irrigation wells, golf course type withdrawals, the consumptive use factor is about 90% of total use, whereas domestic public supply withdrawals, I believe, are somewhere around 13%. Annually, and it also not only varies annually, it also varies monthly. And we used those consumptive use statistics that were developed by NJDEP for their state water supply master plan. Okay, and now we're starting to look at, let's look at capacity with respect to water use, and these are just a series of several maps that show the base flow 10-year recurrence interval minus groundwater use. So now we're starting to look and try and define basins that are currently stressed or more stressed than others with respect to the amount of water that's withdrawn. And here the first map is the 10-year using subtracting consumptive water use. And the one on the right is subtracting total water use, just to show some give you an idea of the variation.
If I could,
yeah.
A lot of our work and effort has gone into taking complex information, reducing it to very simple form. The council will work from this type of format, where the results of the analysis that reflects the policy decisions the council will make will be reflected into a series of maps that are color-coded based upon the limitations on future growth or the capacity of natural systems to provide for both human and ecological need. That informs the land use capability map. But behind that is a whole series of technical analysis that leads to a number, in this case, number of millions of gallons of water per day that can support existing and future population growth. That future population growth is what becomes the capacity limitations on growth that are related to each of these little spatial areas, what we call hydrologic unit code. So that's how the information ultimately can be reduced in a form that could be incorporated into a land use capability map and be implementable at a local level. But addresses the region's resource as a whole. I'm sorry, Adam.
It's okay. All right. So This is looking at our low flow margin minus groundwater use, and again, we're looking at consumptive use and total use, and you can see that in using our more conservative water capacity estimates, more basins become affected with respect to capacity and the amount of use. And then we also provided an additional series of maps, and this is sort of a basin stress factor or basin stress ratio, and this kind of what it is is this map is consumptive groundwater use divided by the capacity to low flow margin. So as the ratio that equation works closer to the number one, the greater the basin is essentially closer to exceeding the capacity of water that's available at one of the given flow regimes with respect to the 10, the 25, and the low flow margin. And you can see, it's essentially, it's where the population is. It's where the population, the pumping is, the impervious surface. And you can see the Route 80 corridor there. It's the Phillipsburg area, northwestern Bergen County, and, southeastern Morris County areas where there are heavy water withdrawals for public supply.
And you can break out that analysis. The last category, the greater than 5.0.5, to show a more subtle variation. So as we get closer to 1, which is obviously the breaking point, so to speak, you can map that out so we know where.
Right. We've done that. Actually, all these little numbers on here are the actual number for each basin. So, right, all the dark ones are over 50, and by over 50, there are some that are over, I think the greatest one is like 1.4, 1.5.
And the breaking point is, 1 is 100% of the low flow margin, right, is currently committed use.
Mm-hmm.
So the breaking point may not be 1 or 100%, because some of that water has to be available to sustain stream flows during low flow conditions or the ecological use. So the council, using an example, if the council decides that 50% is the policy decision under which we're going to minimize risk and maintain ecological function is the maximum amount of low flow that is available for consumptive uses, then 50 or 0.5 becomes the breaking point. And anything that exceeds that would put the resource at risk and is unsustainable. That would essentially be how the analysis would inform subsequent policy decisions.
Okay, the determination of groundwater availability. Well, the USGS can take this so far, and this is where the policy decision comes in with respect to the Highlands Council. So we've provided you capacity maps based on these low flow statistics, and now the decision has to be made with respect to what percentage of that capacity is available or would be used as a threshold for sustainability, and then from there you subtract the basin consumptive water use, and that's where the groundwater availability mapping comes in. So much for the low flow statistical methods. We have a few slides on this. It's sort of a new type of or a new method. It's called hydroecological integrity assessment, more affectionately known as EcoFlow goals. And what this does is we're not only looking at the low flow factors of streams, we're looking at the other components of stream flow. And this is the magnitude, the frequency, the duration, the timing, the rate of change. We're looking at high high flows also. And so what this does, it's an alternative method of quantifying the amount of water needed to protect the ecological integrity of streams, because we know that variations in these components affect biodiversity, reproductive cycles, and species species abundance with respect to streams and promoting healthy streams.
The one comment the council will get when we start getting into policy discussions is we do not have a sufficient enough understanding of what the flow need of a stream is to keep it healthy. And to some extent, that's a valid point. There are two conditions of stream flow: low flow during drought conditions, which affects water supply, and high flow. And both are important. Both are affected by patterns of land use. The analysis recognizes we cannot define flow needs of streams to keep streams healthy because we don't have all the information. That's what this is intended to look at, is a next generation method of what do we need to answer that question. What the low flow method does is provide a safety net on changes of stream flow. Not what the need is, but to ensure that future land decisions do not significantly change the flow characteristics of a stream. So essentially, it minimizes risk that future changes will impair flow needs of streams, and then we'll continue to look at the flow need question into the future.
Okay. So as I said, this method is relatively new. The protocols are still being developed with respect to how this fits, the analysis using this assessment would fit into stream flow with respect to stream flow integrity and regulatory policy decisions. Also, right now, you could not implement this regionally in the Highlands without a very detailed watershed model. Right now, this method is essentially used just where you have long-term stream flow gauging data. Oops. What we did, the council asked us to do a pilot study, though, looking at four particular basins within the Highlands. And what this method does is that there are computer programs that define those 10 flow components, the magnitude, the high, the low, the frequency, low and high flow. And what we have here on the bottom is a low flow or a frequency histogram of values of all January minimum flows for a particular basin. And what we try to do here is withdraw, or to see how much water we could safely withdraw without breaking one of these 10 index values. And the index value is the median value of each one of these 10 flow components. And there are a variety of percentages or thresholds that you can use. You can use the 25-75. The 40-60 is a bit more restrictive. And this is, again, where policy decisions have to be made with respect to the threshold range that you're using. Are you just concerned about a particular one of these indices of the flow components? Do you want to break one of them? Do you want to break two of them? So for the pilot study, we looked at the four basins: Ringwood Creek near Ringwood, Westbrook near Wanacue, Mohawkaway Creek at Van Sickle, and Lamington, the Black River near Pottersville, New Jersey. And as I said, what we tried to do is we withdrew water from the particular basin or stream, and we wanted to bend those indices until they broke. As the withdrawal percent increased, the index value changed until you broke that selected percentage threshold, whether it be 25, 75, 40, or 60. And we wanted to know what is the maximum withdrawal that a stream system can take before altering that index beyond the threshold. That was the major purpose of it. Basin locations, we chose small headwater basins less than 35 miles squared. The gauge basins, again, were unregulated and at least had 20 years of continuous daily discharge data. And then we did a comparison with respect to the 100% of the low flow margin that we calculated for those basins. And what we see here is for the Lamington and the Mohawkaway Creek, the low eco flow maximum withdrawal for, I think this is duration of high flow and minimum low flow, were more conservative than our low flow margin with respect to the amount of water you could withdraw from that particular basin. However, in comparing Westbrook and Ringwood, we can see that the low flow margin is actually a bit more conservative than the eco flow maximum withdrawal to break the first indices there. And I think that's the frequency of high flows. Then, you know, again, okay, this is at the 25-75% threshold. If you went to the 40-60% threshold, the eco flow would be significantly more conservative than the low flow margin. So these are some of the things we looked at. We did comparisons of this study with our low flow analysis, and these are some of the results. We have much more in some of the technical memos that we're providing, and essentially that's where we're at.
And some of these are to determine what the council needs to consider for the next iteration of the plan. So it's important to make sure that at least the initial iteration of the plan is defensible, but also how we can inform the next iteration of the plan based more on an ecologically driven process, and that's what this was intended to do. In terms of next steps, what's coming to the council is staff, and I want to extend again my gratitude and appreciation to Dan Van Abs, which has really been instrumental in guiding this particular process. Is the next step is to the staff is currently working with USGS to get an understanding of the basis upon which a policy recommendation will be made to council. That policy recommendation will address primarily two issues. What percentage of the low flow margin should be utilized for purposes of assigning future consumptive uses or future human use of available water, and secondly, what degree of protection or minimization of risk should be assigned through applying back the existing consumptive use as a more conservative estimate. The belief being in the prior discussions with council and committee has been is the belief and recommendation that it would be better to give more water away in the future than to give too much water away in this first iteration of the plant, because once it is given away, it is very hard to pull back. So the method is intended to be somewhat conservative, although very defensible and valid. And the staff will come to present the recommendation on ultimately what the colors of that map is going to be. Once the policy decision are made, this is done. And that this aspect on water capacity informs a piece of the land use capability map. It is only a piece. There are other factors such as ecological factors, natural resource, or other constraints on land use that may limit ability to utilize this water because there just isn't development opportunity.
Steve, during my time as mayor, I had a lot of dealings with the DEP about water capacity. And as these maps showed, the Parsippany area was pretty dark. I mean, it's stressed. But, and when I would meet with them, they would talk about the capacity of the aquifer. We're in the Berry Valley aquifer. And so obviously they had a way of measuring what the capacity of the aquifer was and how much water was there and how it was being impacted, because they would tell me that it was going down. So my question is, if you can measure what the capacity of all the aquifers are, which is where all the water comes from, wouldn't that be simpler than these methodologies, which I will try to understand going forward?
We can do that for a number of the Berry Valley aquifer systems, and we have done that, provided groundwater models to DEP that can tell you something about availability and how it affects groundwater levels. You can't really do that over large areas of the highlands because it's fractured rock systems. We don't have the data. We don't have the mapping. We don't know how all those fractures interconnect. So that's why we're looking at, we're using a watershed-based approach over the region, because besides the Berry Valley glacial aquifers, you really don't have these large regional flow systems that we can assess with respect to capacity.
If I can add to that, you had the advantage or disadvantage, depending on how you saw it, of being in a very data-rich area. And there are large chunks of the highlands where we don't have that information, so we're using this approach. But what we can use those models for, and there are four or five of them, is a way of calibrating the percentages that we're looking at for when we're saying, well, what sort of percentage of the low-flow margin should be allocable, if you will. Well, we can then look at the results of the models and see whether the models bear that out. And if they do, then we have a good match, and we can have a sense of comfort that applying to the rest of the highlands is valid.
Also, then, could you say that after you go through the stream flow of different methodologies, those areas where you do have good aquifer numbers, could you use that to verify the stream flow data?
Yeah, you try to make comparisons, and there are the models, there are a couple of other pieces of information that we can use in that way. What we're seeing is that the stress areas that have been identified through this approach are, in fact, the ones that we would have expected to see. And qualitatively, that's fine, but then we're getting down to really solid numbers, and that's more important.
Plan has always envisioned what we affectionately call an adjustment revision process, in which when we present regional standards to a municipality, or a county may have a better, more informed, more current information that may justify either a relaxation of a standard, less, or more strict standard in certain areas. And we've always envisioned that a part of applying this information at a municipal level is working with those municipal and county partners during plan conformance to make sure that there isn't anything better. And if there is, to allow for adjustments to incorporate that.
The other thing I would note about the models that do exist is that all of them were developed before there was a great deal of research and knowledge on ecological flows issues. And so they were calibrated to basically reservoir or aquifer level, but not to stream flow needs for ecological purposes. So that's an additional factor.
And part of the challenge, too, with regional planning is currently the way land use planning decisions are made locally, it is not without the benefit of this type of information. So you establish uses of land that municipalities are required to under law that may or not be achievable, and the consequences of those land uses are uncertain. Typically, the towns have to deal with those consequences on a project-by-project basis, but the cumulative effects of all the development or land use decisions are not well understood. What this does is help understand cumulative effects of all the land use decisions that are made by all the municipalities and have an understanding of its implication so that a town can zone accordingly to the capacity or the capacity limitations of our natural resources to sustain human need. So this sort of puts the answer up front so that a municipal zoning board or planning board can make a decision that's based upon the answers than rather have to go through the answers or try to find the answers on a development application.
To what extent, when we get into the policy, well, first let me thank Otto, thank you for the presentation. But when we get into as we move into the policy decisions that you've outlined, to what extent do we have precedence from other state or regional agencies, and to what extent are we on our own?
With respect to applying...
Well, to extent to that, for example, to the methodology, yes. or the cutoff points.
It is the belief, and I wish Tom was here, that the Act gives very broad authority to the Council to make a determination of what are the protection needs of resources within the Highlands region. What is challenging is in some cases that authority overlaps the authority of other state or federal agencies. In this case, the statutory authority for granting allocations of water is that of the Department of Environmental Protection, and nothing in this will change that statutory authority. But what this does is inform local land use zoning in a way that hopefully will be compatible with meeting DEP's statutory authority so that we avoid the potential for conflict between local municipal land use zoning planning land use decisions and state policy with regard to resource protection. So this sort of creates the bridge between state policy and permit decisions under the statutory DEP and local land use decision making, so that it empowers municipalities to zone according to state policy for resource conservation. So we have the authority, and it creates a bridge, although there is a degree of overlap with other state agency jurisdictions.
I was just going to say that I think I've asked this similar question in past meetings, and maybe Dante can add a little more information. But it's my understanding from what Tom has explained to us, in the DEP rules, there's this harmonization that we're reaching for. And also down the road, the council may look at rulemaking.
Yes.
So there may be a further reach of our goals than exists today in terms of water allocation permits, for instance.
I agree with that. The statutory authority is there, and plus the commitment on the part of the agencies to have the kind of coordination that we need. So I think the first step is to have the council determine appropriate resource protections and then move to those other tools, because you're right, Tracy, those do exist, and we have ample authority under the statute to protect resources the way we deem best, and then it's a matter of coordination to follow.
I should also note that although the details on both sides have to be worked out, USGS is currently under contract to DEP to apply the low-flow margin method statewide for the new water supply plan. So they are using the same conceptual framework that we have been proceeding on here.
And that's really important. In the paper, it's pointed out, and I know we've discussed this in the past, that the state at this point uses an imperfect measurement technique when doing their water allocation permits. And this, the 20% rule that they've been using was really developed not for Highlands-type geology. And that rule really is being applied here by the state, but doesn't work here in terms of resource protection and also in terms of good management. So that's really good news. And, you know, we had heard that NJGS was, and USGS in there trying to make them both work together, I think is really important.
Well, in the same way that our plan and our development of good science and approaches will help inform and improve the state plan, the same thing ought to be able to happen with DEP's rules and with other agency rules. I mean, the Act clearly gives us the authority to be the point group, the point entity, and so we can continue to have that kind of effect. And that's why the sooner we can come out with the plan, have it good, solid, science-based, the more we can influence these other policies. And there has been a willingness on the part of the other actors to incorporate. And so we think this will be a very healthy process for everybody.
Healthy governmental policies. Right. Yeah, I would hope that the department, I think they are, given all the indications, would pick this up, as Tracy said, and sort of use it to fix the process so that everybody recognizes. I mean, Steve described the municipal zoning doesn't take this into account. I think some of the other regulatory processes also don't do that. But John, I took your question a little bit differently, and that is within the range of those decisions, how do we inform our choice? That's what I thought it was. Okay. So I guess maybe one thing you want to mention, in the resource committee, when we started this conversation, we laid out a series of sort of policy considerations that we would think would take into place. But I don't know how that's going to make its way back into this process, as a complement to the quantitative analysis that USGS is doing.
The track that we're on, both in terms of scheduling issues, just to advance this to an expeditious conclusion, and complexity, is the staff is hammering auto to get the full understanding of the ramifications leading to a staff recommendation. That recommendation will have reflected the input and guidance provided by committee and council members to date, and will be based upon a sound understanding and vetting of the analysis. To the extent possible, that staff recommendation to council is going to try to capture all the input that we've received from the committee review to date. And that's sort of the thought process of how we would bring policy action to a conclusion. And as a next step, and it's not going to be easy. It's very complex. It is to understand and then to justify that policy decision given the range of possibilities. And my concern is that it would just become overwhelming to the council to talk about all the realm of possibilities and the implications of it each, plus impractical in terms of time.
It may be impractical, but I think we're up to the task. I guess we should talk about that perhaps, in committee. I think there ought to be a discussion of those broader policy concerns, because those are the ones, before it comes to a full staff recommendation of a single set of criteria or thresholds, that then gets debated. Because I think when you boil all this down, what people are concerned about it. Are these statistical analyses going to mimic the protection of pristine streams? Or is the water allocation decisions going to provide enough water for agriculture and for growth? And that's really, that's the context in which the council needs to make the decisions informed by the science and the best possible. And that's, there is, you classically talk about that leap between science and policy, and there's a judgment value there that's going to take a little bit of talk.
Yeah.
So you have to balance that, your pragmatism about the schedule with the debate that needs to happen.
We're here to serve.
Yes.
I have a question for Tim. Tim, since I don't really believe that everybody on this council is going to be able to master all of the fine points of all of these different methodologies, my question is, do you understand them?
I understand, but it brings back nightmares of my statistics class. Thank God Otto stuck with it.
Because to some degree, at least to validate, not that I doubt the staff, but to validate whatever we're going to be looking at, we will be looking at resource committee to do that.
Yeah.
And so I just hope you guys
Well, I think we'll be looking, I think you're right, committee will be looking at the full council, and then we will be proposing a plan and looking to the public comment we get on what we've got on that. Other comments? We have another presentation to go through here. Other comments or questions? Well, thank you, Art.
Okay, thank you.
This was very helpful for, I think, raising all our understanding. That's all that we have to learn. There are a couple of people standing in the lobby. There are four chairs here.
So the second demonstration that, if I can use the term, technical memo that we want to introduce comes at this from a different angle. That the regional master plan is looking at both where land development is inappropriate and what the constraints on land development are, but also from the perspective of where is land development appropriate and what level of growth can be accommodated within that available land. How can we use land more efficiently to serve both current and future economic growth needs? So we intentionally picked two examples, one the resource side, the other the smart growth side, to give a flavor to the council of what's coming in the complexity and challenges related to developing a truly regional plan. So Chris Dennis and Megan Lang, Chris is our principal planner, Megan is a regional planner, are going to present information on methods and approaches for identification of regional growth areas. Now, it's important that because these two aspects are being approached at independently, that there will be a second series of decisions that council will have to make to reconcile where resource protection goals overlap or conflict with regional growth goals. And that's anticipated. It shouldn't be a surprise. And there will be a process we will go through to provide the necessary policy decisions from council to reconcile where those conflicts exist. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris and Megan to introduce the approach.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks, Otto. That was very informative. And this is a sort of great follow-up to balancing the spirit of the Act with where those water capacity issues are related to where existing growth is and where future growth could be within the region. And I just wanted to point out, for those of you who didn't know, that the technical memorandums from our discussion on growth areas and the water capacity that Otto described are available at our website, and they were released on July 17th. This is sort of to set the context of where this discussion fits in the regional master plan and in development of the land use capability map. There are the following components of the regional master plan: the resource assessment, where the water and ecological concerns are being addressed, and then coordinating that with the other components, this one particularly, the smart growth component, which includes transportation as well as air quality, utility capacity, and land preservation and stewardship, and TDR. So this is a large encompassing component of the regional master plan. There's also coordination and consistency, where we're working with interagencies, local participation, our TAC, our network, our partnership programs, and the financial implications. The smart growth component specifically reviews that balance between resource protection needs, infrastructure constraints, and opportunities for growth. A component or an element in the framework of the smart growth component is what we refer to as regional development and design. And that technical report will include a variety of analysis, this being one of them, particularly the identification of potential growth areas and redevelopment areas that will inform the land use capability map. So even though we're working as parallel science and planning staff, we really are coordinating so that spatially we come together in that land use capability map to inform each other about the resource and smart growth implications. The redevelopment area technical report is also available at our website and is a separate discussion that to be had, but related to this discussion. The analysis that we're talking about will also inform the identification of potential TDR receiving areas within the Highlands region and looking at where growth may be appropriate to accommodate that type of density with resource protection and capacity. Redevelopment, in the context of the regional master plan, is opportunities that are limited to those areas that either have previously been developed and or have existing contamination. And redevelopment may occur in both the planning and the preservation areas, as was stated in the Act. Specifically in the preservation areas, it's prescribed in the Act at its 70% impervious surface, or areas that are brownfields, and would come through a preservation area protocol through the Council and DEP to evaluate those sites. We will be looking at them in the context of preservation areas at this level. Growth areas are larger areas in the planning area, and they have the potential to accommodate some growth, including new development and redevelopment. So that's sort of the dichotomy of both of these, however they're correlated in their analysis and data layers. The current policy directive from the Council is that all growth-inducing standards are voluntary. Therefore, conformance with the Regional Master Plan does not mandate the acceptance of the growth standards. And so as you come into conformance and you look at the land use capability map, we'll be having conversations about where you are locally and finding how you can align yourself with the Regional Master Plan and the mandatory and voluntary components of it, or required and discretionary, as we've said.
Isn't it correct that that's legislatively mandated? It's not a policy decision on our part not to mandate growth. We're not allowed to mandate growth. Isn't that correct? The growth standards. I think it's important that people realize that it's not a policy decision on our part. It's a legislative directive from the law.
Yes.
Well, our standards that we are establishing, right, that direct that, and whether they are accepted as voluntary acceptance.
Correct. The overall, the Act is not forcing growth in its implementation. The standards that we developed in support of that legislative initiative were decided by Council to be voluntary also.
Kurt, the subtlety is that the Act provides that in the planning area our plan is voluntary.
Right.
But it's a different issue, the one that Chris is speaking about. What she's saying is, in developing what we're going to have for the planning area, we could choose to say it's going to be mandatory if you decide you want to opt in. What we're saying is more, the policy choice was more forgiving to towns than that. It was saying, even if you decide to opt in, you don't have to mandate. You're not going to have to accept the growth. So we're going beyond the Act to be more acceptable to towns and their ability to vary. So it's part of it is what the Act says, but part of it is also a policy choice to put things into the planning area that will not mandate growth, even if they're conforming.
That's also true for TDR receiving areas.
Correct. That's a good thing.
Right. Yeah, it's a very positive thing for towns, and we think positive for participation in the conformance process. And that's, again, where we as a council think we can partner with municipalities to work together in doing it. And towns need not be afraid of conforming and working with us on the plan, because we're not forcing anything down their throat, even where we could choose to make this more onerous on them.
Are we clear on that? I think that's an important distinction.
Just to add to that, we did receive some comments opposing that sentence. There are individuals and groups who feel we could have gone a different way. There are people who feel we should have.
The potential growth area identification, the purpose is really in accordance with the Act to identify areas in the planning area that may be able to sustain appropriate development, redevelopment, and growth. And again, I pointed out that redevelopment may happen in both planning and pres where appropriate. And in the planning area, there would be the growth area identification component. The approach for doing this is really twofold. One of them is to have a larger, sort of broader context regional evaluation. I think what you've seen from the groundwater analysis is that we have very good local information. Sometimes it's inconsistent, but how do we approach this from a regional level using the best available data that we have to inform that process? And so we've established something we call growth evaluation areas. And we're going to use GIS data to establish threshold indicators to help inform where existing community diversity of land uses, what they currently are, where they exist, what are the populations that are associated with those land uses and densities, where are existing employment locations and jobs throughout these communities, where existing transportation and transit options exist, as well as utility infrastructure for water and sewer, and power, and the capacity. And it's important to know that we need to know the capacity of what those infrastructure and systems are. And then we need to refine this sort of broader approach with growth of these growth evaluation areas by looking at them in the context of the environmentally constrained lands and within the thresholds of that water and sewer capacity so that we can understand the existing conditions, the nature of the resource protection that's required, and what are the thresholds for moving forward. I think I missed one. Hold on. There we go. Okay. Areas that may potentially be appropriate for receiving growth will be identified, and we've come up with broad categories, including lands that do not contain significant environmental constraints, the nature and extent of existing development, the proximity to transportation and transit, and access to available utility infrastructure and capacity. These will be further refined as we developed an approach for thresholds to evaluate those growth evaluation areas, looking at the context of these areas. Some of the data sources, and this is not exhaustive, nor is it in any particular order of importance for this presentation. It was what fit into the slide best. Okay, so existing development, that's some of our primary sources. Or we're looking at 2000 U.S. Census Bureau population figures. We're going to talk to that in more detail and actually show you a new mapping process that we've applied throughout the region. Department of Labor third quarter employment data. It's the most recent employment data through the whole region, which looks at the actual number of jobs and establishments within each community that's been spatially attributed to where it exists within that community. Impervious surface data. We'll talk again in more detail about how that data will inform this analysis and how it's being used in a variety of resource and growth evaluations. That data was from satellite data and refined down to a smaller area. DEP, land use land cover data. We had the ability to work with preliminary draft data for the Highlands region from the DEP for 2002 land use land cover and look at that in the context of other land use conditions. Transportation, we've been gathering existing road network and local and county and interstate roads from DOT, trying to get the best, most up-to-date rail, bus, and bus terminal and bus route information that we can get for the region. Where are park and rides? Where are those park and rides being used for? What's the current occupancy and condition of those park and rides? Then looking at the utilities and infrastructure. Where are the existing areas served and full sewer service areas? And particularly when you talk about sewer, you're looking at areas that have pipes in the ground versus where that larger area is identified to be. We also did that for water supply, where you look at the areas served, water supply areas that have pipes in the ground versus the full franchise areas where water supply may be anticipated. The environmental data, which is really the land use capability map and all of the data that's supporting the resource assessment for the land use capability map, slopes, flood-prone, flood hazard areas, open waters, riparian corridors, threatened and endangered species, all of the data that's going into that analysis will be underlying as we look at this growth implication or evaluation. We also used a variety of sources from that existed from agency partners, and local sources. The State Development Redevelopment Plan, what are guidelines for planning areas and centers? What's the current state map? What has happened from cross-acceptance? What is that information and the most up-to-date on that? State initiatives and programs such as Transit Village, Urban Enterprise Zone or International Zone, Main Street, New Jersey, where is there a special improvement district, a business improvement district? Where is local aid and economic development projects? Site mark, where are sites that are being marketed for redevelopment? We've also looked at designated redevelopment areas that exist throughout the region. We've compiled Highlands Contaminated Site Inventory, existing list of sites that have been identified. That's also been released at our website. How the build-out analysis will be used to inform this, where existing developed and undeveloped lands are, and what's the developable areas that may be available in the future. Tax assessor data, Mod 4 data, what are the current parcel data and the assessed values and occupancy and vacancy and all of that information to help inform what's going on the ground as to land values and their existing location. This is sort of a matrix that I want to point out. There's growth area and redevelopment indicators here, particularly because we put up the preservation area on this slide to sort of show you the balance between preservation and planning area. So, pointer. Here's preservation area, which would be really in the context of the redevelopment, and then growth areas, which would be the planning area, which would be for both. And we've come up with a certain set of analysis, sort of what I've talked to you about so far, and what are some of the data that we're looking at associated that I've mentioned, and some of the primary and secondary indicators for each type within the Highlands region. And we are blind to the line for all of the resource components and on the growth end need to live within what are the specifics of the planning and the preservation area. What we've done is we've researched from the State Development Act, from criteria for planning areas and centers, as well as other planning sources, both locally and nationally, to find out what are sort of the components for transportation that create walkability linked to rail stations. That nuance between pipes in the ground versus full service areas. What are some of the impervious surface criteria? This one is spelled out for us. We know that at 10% impervious surface, water quality is affected. Looking at municipal employment data, this came from the state as well as local on the ground conditions, finding the best for the region for those breaks, and looking at population densities that are out there. All of this is still in the process of development by the staff, and it will help to define thresholds and make information that the council could consider for policy decisions. At first, we needed some way to broadly approach the region so that we could start evaluating what conditions existed on the ground and how we can move forward with this data. So that's sort of where those numbers came from. Dissymmetric mapping. This is one of those examples where we looked at actually how population data can be aggregated so that you can be more informed when looking at a map as to where people are actually living on the ground. We started out with census data, and we reallocated population within census boundaries, that being block or block group. And then we had to figure out, well, where are people living within that block or block group based on a set of conditions? Some of those are the environmental constraints to development, streams, steep slopes, wetlands. We also, from this exercise, found out that people are living on constrained lands. We have population being reported out for excessive steep slopes, for wetlands, along streams. And so we have identified for us people who are living in environmentally sensitive areas already. And then we looked at existing land uses, using the DEP data for land use land cover, where are residential and non-residential areas, and looking at that. And we took that data and we analyzed it across the whole region using a weighted average by county for distributing this population. An algorithm was established by our consultant to help further refine how those population block and block group data are living on the ground and redistributing them. Other features, we also looked at preserved land and road right-of-ways that might influence where you're living on the ground. The goal of this mapping is to determine how population and employment are spatially distributed within a block group in the Highlands, and I'll show you a picture of what that looks like. What this is called is preserving the pycnophylactic properties. I'm waiting to use that word. That is...
We're going to present that at the next council meeting.
People, pycnophylactic is people are not destroyed or manufactured during the redistribution process. So we did not create or destroy any of the population while we moved them around to reallocate them within this spatial distribution. This is an example of what a typical census block group might look like for an area of Morris County. And this is population densities that are on the ground as reported out from the Census Bureau down to the block and the block group level. And you can look at this and it's informative, and you can break it up however you want to do with colors and looking at the breaks in density. And further dense areas are shown in darker color, and where population densities are decreased are shown in a lighter color. What isometric mapping does is sort of all those things I was talking about. It's going to reallocate those population based on where they are on the ground. And what it does is it takes those block group information and distributes them spatially within the context of those land use conditions on the ground, environmentally constrained areas, and it helps us further see where actual residential populations are living at a density. And now we can correlate that to where are the jobs within those communities, where are the resources, where are the infrastructure. And you can start building this level of analysis that's very refined. This isometric mapping approach is being used across the nation as ways to better look at how we can refine broad population and density data down to a local land use decision-making level, and in this case, inform regional perspectives. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Just a point to clarify. When you're talking about reallocating or redistributing population, this is for the purpose of analysis, not physical. We're not moving people.
We do not create or destroy anybody.
It's voluntary.
It's redistribution of population numbers at the census level, the smallest level obtainable within that same spatial area, considering existing residential and non-residential land uses, roads, and environmental constrained lands. So you can, sort of set your breaks in this so that you can look at where those numbers are. That population number never changes. It just comes to the ground in a different space.
So Warren County has 100,000 people, mm-hmm. and they are where they are, concentrated in Phillipsburg, Hackettstown, Washington Borough.
Increasingly.
How would this, so we had a map, a reality map for that, mm-hmm. and you would do this analysis. What would it look like and what purpose would it serve?
Okay, this is what you would say. If you said there are 100,000 people living in Dover, the town of Dover, and that was the total population for the town of Dover, which is sort of on the lower left-hand corner, right in here. And this is just for example. You know, I don't really know the number, but let's say it's that. Those 100,000 people are represented by these census blocks at that density. So reporting out for the town of Dover, we know that that many people are living within that census area. And then what this process does is they're not living evenly distributed across that spatial area. They're living within that area, not on the road, not on open space or preserved lands, and not in the middle of the river. Some of them are living on wetlands, and some of them are living in wetland buffers. And some of them are living on slopes, but maybe not the case in Dover, but in another area. So what this process does is take that population number. Let's say for this cell, it's 50,000 people. It keeps that number at 50,000, keeps the overall number for Dover at 100,000, and it now redistributes them within the spatial areas that are available or most likely represent where those people live on the ground.
Calculated density?
Mm-hmm. And an area of where they're actually living.
So the benefit is it gives you a more accurate picture of where people are actually living.
A realistic density. Because you've taken out all the constrained lands.
Now if we started bringing in the HUC layers and other resource layers, you can start seeing where existing populations and existing infrastructure are in correlation to other resource areas.
Yeah, how this information will be used when we talk about regional growth, the Act defines it as in and adjacent to areas already used for that purpose. So this helps both define the area used for that purpose and also the intensity of that existing use. So as we talk about density standards and design standards they can be made compatible with community character by having a better understanding of how people are currently living.
But I think the point that you all need to emphasize, that if you take it out of the planner's speak, you're trying to more accurately describe where people are.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We're not reallocating people. We're not assigning them to any place. This is just more accurate than a block.
More accurate than that.
Right. Yes. So just the descriptive part's getting lost in this. You're just trying to describe reality. Mm-hmm. This is not your plan for where you're going to move people.
Absolutely not. This is not new data. This is existing data spatially represented in a unique way. This is the map that was released as part of the technical memorandum for the region, and it indicates sort of a population density that we used a natural break on per acre throughout the region. You can see some of the roads in here, particularly the slope restriction you can see. And actually, there may be people living on those slope areas, probably not in great numbers, but they're out there, because we do have people living on constrained lands. Is everyone okay with that? Mm-hmm.
Is the yellow slopes?
Yeah, the yellow are areas where population, they're areas that are not included. They're either parkland, waters, open space, mm-hmm, or slopes above 15% in this case.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be showing an example later in the presentation that I think will actually show a little bit more how this might apply when trying to determine growth areas.
That's a good point. Megan's going to take you through a layering of this data, moving to next step. This one may be easier, impervious surface. This analysis was gathered from satellite data, and it was from 1991 through 2000, and it looked at the percentage of impervious surface coverage for each pixel, or 30 by 30 meter grid, which is about 9,680 square feet, or 0.2 acre. So it's taking satellite imagery, looking at light reflection back, and determining what an impervious surface might be based on that reflection, and doing it down to a small grid area throughout the whole region. We also needed to take that data and refine it to get some sense of what we're getting back from that satellite imagery data regarding to what's on the ground as to where are roads and right-of-ways throughout this to further refine it. We worked with Krista on this, as well as our contractor, our GIS contractor consultant, and the Highlands Council staff, to come up with an impervious surface analysis that could inform not only this component, but also the resource components regarding water ecosystem. And so it's multi-use.
Impervious, there's two ways of looking at intensity of existing use of land. One is how much of the land area has been altered, clear, disturbed. The other is the intensity of the use in terms of how much of the land has been replaced by something other than the vegetated community, impervious cover. So we are looking at both. It informs multiple aspects of the plan. The degree of impervious cover is a direct has a direct relationship on the quality and quantity of water, of pollutants entering the waterway. It has the amount of impervious cover has a bearing on the resulting ecological integrity of the surrounding area. So it informs the multiple aspects of the plan, and it's all based upon the same information.
The Act actually spells out impervious, just to be clear, that it includes porous paving, paver blocks, gravel, crushed stone, decks, patios, elevated structures, and other similar structures. So we have a broad range of what is described as impervious based on the Act. The next picture is the regional picture of the impervious areas for the map. This was released as part of that technical memorandum. And you can see that we have increased areas. It starts at 10 to, I think, I can't really see that, 25, I think, and going 29, then 30 to 49, and then 50.
I need 50 to 69.
50 to 69, thank you. And then above 70% and above. So really the 70% mark is presented out here. It's hard to see at this level, but certainly the map is available for further review at our website. Now Megan's going to give an example of what an approach might be for looking at these growth evaluation areas from a broader context and how these data layers will come together. I've showed you the disymmetric and the impervious surface. But if we think of that matrix that I presented, there are other data layers that are going to start informing this process as we start looking at them and coming up with what they mean.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I'm going to show a really simplified version of what a growth evaluation mapping exercise might actually look like.
Can you put the microphone
over
right here? Thank you.
So it'll be a very simplified version of what our analysis will actually look like, but hopefully it will give a good sense of what layering the different map layers will do, and also bringing in some of those thresholds that we talked about earlier in the presentation. So again, being that this is this simple version, we haven't actually included a legend, and I'm just going to sort of talk through what you're seeing. So this image shows a community in the Highlands. The green color indicates the preservation area, and the white color indicates the planning area. This example of community was initially identified because of the train station that's in the middle. That's, again, sort of in terms of what gives us the cues that there might be some potential for growth in the area. Well, in this case, it was because of that train station. This next image, we've added the population to the area, so the disymmetrically mapped population. And just to say, we haven't added anything else, so this is really just the population. So when you do see sort of those blank spots coming through, that might potentially be because there is an environmental feature in the area, maybe some open space or undeveloped. But again, as you can see, you sort of get a greater level of detail in terms of where there's a greater density of people living in that area. Next, we added the impervious surface coverage. This impervious surface was set to notice any area that has 25% or greater level of impervious surface coverage. You can see there's some darker areas. And I think this is very helpful in understanding some of the land use and intensity of development, particularly if you look, there's some areas where it's really dark, indicating there's a high level of impervious surface coverage, but there isn't necessarily a population that correlates to it. So that gives us some additional cues as to what's there. It might be because there's retail and commercial uses. Also, if there's no population and no impervious surface coverage, again, it might indicate that it's open space or undeveloped as of yet. This next slide, we've added the existing wastewater area served, which means the actual pipes in the ground. This is new draft data layer that's been developed for the region based on existing information and billing records. It really matches the wastewater surface areas with the parcel-based information. And the detail that you're seeing there is really sort of the blocks coming through. And finally, we added a half-mile buffer around that train station, which now it's a little hard to see, but what this is, it's considered a ped shed in transportation planning terms, and it's the distance that a person might comfortably walk to access transportation. And this has been added just because it's an important component to consider when you're thinking about possible new growth and redevelopment. If there is a train station, it would be great to sort of direct that development to where it can access it. So that's it for the example. On to next steps. The next steps that need to be undertaken as part of this analysis is to finalize the policy criteria for the identification of redevelopment and growth evaluation areas. Then once we've finalized those, the next step is to actually identify the areas with redevelopment potential and to actually define the growth evaluation areas and to delineate them. Of course, both of these will be refined to exclude areas that are constrained by significant natural resources pursuant to the resource assessment and also adjusted to reflect the available potable water and wastewater capacity limitations pursuant to the utility analysis. The final point is just that this discussion of growth areas will continue during the plan conformance process, and that's the time when local input will help to refine and extend those areas. I think that's it.
So in terms of what's coming down the pipe, the planning staff has been, done a tremendous amount of work compiling the information that's necessary to provide a basis for how we define growth areas. Megan is evaluating those different criteria to provide a staff recommendation to council on the policies that will actually define the line. Those lines ultimately will inform the development of the land use capability map and will have to be refined once they're integrated with the resource constraints. Now let's just connect the water capacity to these growth area identification. Once we have growth area identified, we can take the capacity limitations that come out of the work that USGS is doing and overlay it and understand what the growth potential of that area is, or is there any growth potential given the limitations in existing resources. So it's a process of evaluation, identification, reconciliation, and then ultimately adoption. So even though a growth area may meet all the conditions of having impervious cover and population concentrations and six train stations and a bus stop, it may not have the water to grow. So for that purpose alone, it may not be identified as a growth area in the plan. But those are decisions that the council will have to make as we move forward over the next several months.
But Steve, to that point, that example you just gave, without the water that you suggested, it might not be suitable for a growth area. But would that be exclusionary, or could there be some accommodation made that would allow water to be brought in?
And
then create a growth area.
There are many, many complex issues that will come out of ultimately the policy decisions that were made by council, and I would argue the plan itself. Some of those we can address based upon the wealth of information and knowledge that we have. Many we will not be able to, and we have always discussed that there will be a plan B. The plan lives on, and much of the next iteration of the plan will be informed by both what we learned from and the limitations of the first plan. And that's important to recognize because we will not be able to answer all the questions. We will not be able to address everyone's concerns in this first iteration. But we are doing a great job of doing some very cutting-edge work, and I would argue that we're ahead of a lot of the pack in terms of having a handle on what those answers are.
But I think in terms of Jack's question, the answer to that is it's a policy determination the council will make. It may refine as time goes on.
I was going to say the same thing, Mr. Chairman. That I guess the other part of that would be a recommendation of the staff to anticipate how you would take us through a decision-making process. Obviously, you could bring water lines in east, probably most cases here, to do that with all sorts of ramifications that need to be considered as to when it's appropriate to do that or not to do that. And I don't know how we're going to, I can't see we're not going to have to face some of those questions in the first iteration of the plan and the designation, given where some of the water capacity numbers were in terms of the ratios to the low flow capacities. Right? There were already areas that are already growth areas that were on that borderline of this breaking point. So I guess that's one point. Two of the points. One is, in the other way to do this, your process is an iterative one of defining the growth areas sort of proactively. The other way is to define them by exclusion. And are you thinking about defining the natural resource areas as a way of helping to set bounds as to where the appropriate growth areas are? And the example I think of is, you think of conservation reserve design, where from a habitat perspective, we're trying to protect contiguity and core areas. And that clearly needs to be done in the planning area because of the fact that that's where we're anticipating a higher level of growth. And so I don't know whether that's part of your analysis.
They come together. They're done together. The layers may be layered individually in a different way from planning and science, but ultimately it's that planning and science that's gelled together to make that last decision. And all of the resource, the land use capability map will drive the ultimate decision.
Yep.
think of plan design as a process of reduction, like the capacity or growth area evaluation. Is you take a set range of information that's manageable, you reduce it to one indicator. Then you take a multiple indicators and you have to then merge those together into a regional plan. So it's a process of reduction, taking Otto's complex statistical analysis and 80 years of stream gauging information and reducing it to a Huck 14 map with colors is a reduction of data into a useful format. So just as we've reduced the capacity data to a manageable format, we are reducing growth indicators to a manageable format. Those have to be overlaid, and yes,
right, and again,
the resource values have to be taken into consideration.
And I understand that. And I think, you know, at its most basic, though, what we're doing is defining geographies, right? We're defining where growth happens, where not, where less or no growth is going to happen. And there's going to be a margin, right? In state planning terms, it's the planning area 3. And so the question becomes, where's the benchmark? Do you start with the idea of accommodating the growth and defining that as the hard line, so to speak, or do you go from the opposite direction, which is to define the habitat or water resource areas, the geography needs protected, use that. And in your metaphor of them coming together, you know, you are defining those areas based on this reductionist approach of all this information. But is there a complementary aspect of that that's happening in parallel so that you have those defined geographies?
Yes.
Okay. And then the last question I have, which is just the parking lot, the policy question. The fact that the idea that growth areas will continue to be debated or reassessed during plan conformance, I guess, is a policy question, which I wasn't sure we had tackled. And to me, it raises the worst aspects of the state planning process of negotiation in the face of the science, because I think you are providing, you know, probably the best, most defensible scientific and planning basis in this state, at least probably in a lot of other places. And when you get that out, the boundaries as to how you plan to negotiate that, it seems to me to undermine the conformance aspect. The idea is to bring municipal planning into conformance with our plan, not to go out and make it necessary to negotiate that conformance.
I'd like to disagree with you, Tim.
Well, I'm saying that she's presenting that as a decision to be made.
I understand, but the point you just made is one you had made here before.
Right.
I think that if everything were left up to the scientists or the planners, then there would be no need for elected officials or planning board members in any municipality. So you have to take all of that information that we are going to be providing through our planners and through our scientists, and looking at that then in terms of a policy decision. A policy decision often is related to politics. And I don't mean that in the worst possible sense. I mean that in the sense of accommodating the interests of the people who are represented on the ground. So I'm in favor of exactly what that paragraph says. I think that it does not undermine the process. It helps to make the process realistic, and that pleases me.
Well, I guess not to argue the fact now or to argue the issue now, but I agree with you that there's going to be a debate about policy and decisions that are going to be made. I would argue that that happens in the development of the plan before it's laid to bed and taken out. And in fact, the council did address the idea of sort of partial conformance and partial opt-in. It took a policy position that we were not going to do that. And that this, to me, has echoes of that debate that's reopening it, one I thought we'd settled already.
I just wanted to say, I think this is a matter of debate. And I think what Tim is saying is it makes it look like it's settled in a way that the council did not address yet. We're continuing to debate this issue. And as a matter of fact, we have the policy decisions we have made so far move towards not mandating, for instance, in the partial opt-in, the growth aspects. Mm-hmm. So we have made pieces of policy decisions here that actually are contrary to what that statement sounds like. So I think that's the point, is that this isn't settled. It's a matter of important debate. We'll continue to discuss it. But the pieces that have been settled don't really jive with what that impression that someone may get by reading that.
And for clarification, it's really regarding the voluntary nature of the growth that would happen after or during, you know, planning conformance process. So that's something that is voluntary. It's been those standards. And having that discussion will further refine whether a community decides not to be, you know, to be or not to be a TDR receiving area, to be or not to be, even if deemed appropriate.
And there also needs to be the recognition that much of our baseline information is dated to 2002. There has been a lot of changes that have occurred. We must give the ability for a municipality or a county to inform our plan and make adjustments where conflicts exist. I agree that it needs to be built upon a very clear procedure that ensures that we're not negotiating away policy, but that could be just come back to the council during a post-conformance review, and any changes that are made to the land use capability map would be subject to full council consideration.
You know, one of the things we have to realize is that the data reflecting open space, a lot of municipalities throughout Morris County that have been buying a lot of open space, nobody has an accurate reflection of all of that.
Thank you.
And so we could be defining growth areas and only go out and find out that that property is no longer available.
Because as complicated as this is, we can make it far more complicated, and we can chase data to where there is no conclusion. So we recognize that, and we've drawn a line. And that is going to be a line that we're going to be criticized for when we release a plan, but it is a line that we that we'll address later.
Yeah, I just have a clarification question. The point that you had brought up and you and Jack debated, which specific statement were you referring to?
Discussion of growth areas will continue during the plan conformance process, but may help refine the extent of these areas. That sounds to me like we develop a line, in essence, in the growth areas, put it into a plan. Plan then goes out for performance, and we negotiate where that line falls. Or at least with the opportunity to do that.
You're saying you didn't mean that.
No.
It should be reworked. The language.
We can do that.
That's fine.
I'm sorry that she didn't mean that.
and I think another point is we all know how we are under intense time pressure to get this plan done. And we don't have the luxury of going back and rehashing decisions that we made already, and I think that's something we're going to have to accept and move forward so we get this completed.
I would argue that the two of you don't disagree, but I don't think it's worth it. So hypothetical at this point, I think I'll leave it alone. Are there any other questions?
For Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me just say one thing. Thank you both, Chris and Megan, for doing this. I think from the nature of our questions, one of the things I would stress is to not to make the concept simpler, but to keep the language simple and to avoid the planning words, phrases that require explanation to us and certainly to the general public who will be reading this. Thank you. Okay, now we're going to have a quiz on those two presentations. We'll be handing out the exams. We have two resolutions to consider. The first is concerning a grant to Lebanon Borough.
Yes, Steve, you're right.
Yes, this is an application was submitted from Lebanon Borough for a COA grant that would allow for reimbursement of the costs incurred to prepare their third round submittal. Lebanon Borough is one municipality that did not previously have substantive certification, so they are entitled to a grant amount in the amount of $12,500 under our grant guidelines. We are recommending to council adopt the resolution as proposed, awarding the grant to Lebanon Borough in that amount.
We award the grant to Lebanon Borough.
Second.
Borough.
I have a question. What we had a different. It's been so long now since we set these up. What type of grant was it? We set the $7,500 threshold for.
Yeah, the COA grant program has two thresholds. One is for $7,500. That is reimbursed cost sharing to reimburse costs for third round submissions for towns that previously had substantive certification. The $12,500 is for reimbursement, of course, for third round submittals for those towns that did not previously have a substantive certificate.
Then I'll second the motion if it hasn't been already seconded.
Are there any comments or questions on the resolution? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Okay. The other resolution, we are required to have an ethics officer designate someone to be an ethics officer for the Highlands Council, to whom I guess council members and staff can bring ethical questions and confidence, and can also do their best to ensure that we are operating in conformance with the law standards. Dante has been our ethics officer and has recommended that we alter that, and also that we add an alternate ethics officer in case the person we think is not available. And recommendations are that Kim Kaiser be the ethics liaison officer, is the technical phrase, and Jeff Lajava be the alternate ethics officer. We have a resolution here with blanks in, but entertain a motion.
I so move.
And it would be with those two names.
Yes.
Second.
Dante, do you want to add anything to that?
No, other than by way of background, these two are two staff attorneys. Kim has already been assisting on ethical matters and is well-versed. Jeff Lajava has been doing an excellent job with his general functions. I have also designated them both as the two EEO and AA, that's Equal Employment Opportunity and Affirmative Action Officers, which, you know, another important function that we need to have coverage. So in that capacity, they are already doing a good job to make sure if anyone has concerns about discrimination in the workplace, that we meet our ethical obligations in that regard, then we do it. I believe they would both be excellent candidates to handle the ethics issues as well, and so I strongly recommend moving.
Do you have comments on the
resolution?
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Turn now to public comment part of the meeting. We ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes. You state your name and at least the town in which you live. And we do not make this a question and answer session. If you have questions, you can raise them, and we will try to get back to you another time. And we also ask that you limit your comments to areas that are within our responsibility, and that is primarily about the process and content of the Highlands Regional Master Plan. Listen to your other comments, but we are not the legislature. We cannot amend or change the act, and to the extent those are comments you would like to make, that it's not something particularly within our control. How many people would like to speak? Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Matt Sprung. I live in Randolph Township. I'm here as chairman of the New Jersey Builders Association's Highland Committee. Northern New Jersey, including the Highlands region, is a great place to live, assuming you can afford to live here. Mountains, lakes, people, employment, easy access to shore, skiing, airports, and the greatest city on the face of the earth, just to name a few. We've taken for granted the fact that people from throughout the United States and the world, you know, I forgot I wear these things, I'm getting a little old. Excuse me.
Getting old, man.
I am at that, Mr. Freeholder. Some of the world's best educated people have settled here, demanding exceptional educational facilities, spending money on Main Street, and becoming part of our social fabric while working at world-class companies. It's been a great run. A run in which we did little to facilitate the growth of the economy, an economy that helped grow our standards of living. The world is changing, though. Jobs that we thought were ours through birthright are no longer ours for the taking. Good manufacturing jobs left the area decades ago as a result of the internet and the massive fiber optic cables laid underneath the ocean. Any work done dealing with computers or telecommunication can be done from anywhere in the world. Jobs are going overseas to people who are paid less, however, have less demands on them for their basics of food, clothing, and shelter. They're able to stay in their home country with their relatives and friends and enjoy a relatively high standard of living. They enjoy the jobs generated by our nation's companies, but no longer spend dollars, help reinvigorating Main Street, New Jersey. As a friend of mine, Bob Goldsmith, likes to say, the walking wallets. And they're going to be walking somewhere else and spending their monies in someone else's downtown. This is definitely going to affect the centers in our regions. Tomorrow's industries will be run by brain power. We need to encourage as many engineers, computer scientists, and mathematicians as possible to move to the northern New Jersey Highlands area. These are the people that will bring new industry and jobs to our area, but these people have now more choices than ever. They need no longer to be located in the United States metropolitan area. They don't need to be here to enjoy the benefits of working for our existing industries, but they will have a difficult time recreating what we do have here, a stable government, world-class infrastructure, good climate, plentiful rainfall, and alike. We must capitalize on these and other assets and plan for a successful future. We need to start thinking seriously about how to make North Jersey a place where world-class educated people want to come. We need to plan for people and for the future generations of Highlanders. If we continue along the path of the anti-immigration policy being pursued by certain sects of the environmental community, New Jersey will continue along its path of losing high-paying jobs while gaining lower-paying government jobs. If you haven't already read it, I recommend you read the July 6 Rutgers Regional Report titled New Jersey's New Economic Growth Challenges. We must do everything to help assure a balance between economic success and the maintenance of our environment. In this changing world, we need to be preparing for tomorrow's challenges. How will we attract world-class minds? Now that people do not need to come to the United States for higher-paying jobs, what can we do to attract these people? Or is it our goal that this great area become nothing more than a history lesson, a place where people come one day to hear how great we had it back in the great 20th century? Obviously, we at the New Jersey Builders Association believe that now more than ever, this state needs serious planning to assure a successful future. But frankly, we are at a loss to understand how the council is developing the very important Highlands Regional Master Plan. Committees meet infrequently, and there has been little substantive discussion on the policy issues involved in the formation of a plan. In the June 6th status report, it was reported using the metric of a thermometer that the plan was 60% complete, which we now assume 1 month later would be about 75%. However, after taking a closer look at the progress, we realized that the completion percent measured the technical report analysis, which is only a component and a small component of the regional master plan. It seems that based on our analysis, zero progress has been made on the regional master plan policy guidance document, land use capability map, and implementation framework. My understanding is that the RPM is due out for discussion in September. These missing components are crucial in planning for the region's future. They are the components that will be used to guide us on a daily basis. They need to be vetted openly, and I really appreciated Tim and my freeholder engaging a little bit in debate. And you folks are the decision makers, and it's important that you do engage in debate. So these issues should be vetted openly in the process that will allow time for review and analysis by interested parties. Keeping this in mind, I have several questions. First of all, are the materials listed on the thermometer being shared with all or some of the Highland Council members before they are released to the public? And if so, how? Are there hard copies of these, or are they being done by email? If the materials are being shared prior to public release, are Highlands Council members sharing their observations and opinions with Council staff? And if so, how? Hard copy, email, or by phone? And lastly, when will the actual reports prepared by the consultants on the contract to the Highlands Council be released to the public? I think after listening to this, there's a lot of great debate to be had. Tim brought up some real good points that, you know, certainly as a builder, I'm concerned about. You know, where do we draw the line? You know, at what point do we decide a stream can be impacted, should it be impacted when you're in an area like the New York metropolitan area? We certainly have to look realistically at growth, and I certainly wouldn't want to see this area choked out of existence. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Stiles. I reside in Burnsville, New Jersey, and I'm the Vice President of Conservation for New Jersey Audubon Society. I came here today to also talk about economic growth, and I'm going to save that for probably the August meeting and focus my comments instead on the water-related issues. But keep in mind, there's tons of studies that have been done showing that people decide to locate to an area based upon the quality of the environment, the quality of the parks. What opportunities are there for agrotourism? What opportunities are there for nature-based tourism? So that is an important component of the discussions in regards to economic sustainability and growth. In regards to the water technical report that was provided, the basic formula, and I've sat through too many statistics class in grad school and fallen asleep in several. Low flow minus the water capacity, minus water capacity, which really doesn't allow for this basic touchstone of ecological health. What we saw was an analog. That is, the September low flow is being used as an analog for a threshold or benchmark for basic ecological health protection. If you look at the precautionary principle, which several conservation groups are advocating in fisheries, you need to demonstrate that no harm will occur through a certain action. Again, we know that in several streams in the highlands that the low flow in September is already below an ecological health protection standard. We would clearly ask, per the council policy discussions and legislative mandates, that you make a deterministic finding in what the appropriate level is currently based upon the best available science for ecological health. To simply assume that using the metric of the low flow in September is akin to protecting ecological health, there's no information provided to this council or perhaps to the staff to make that finding. I appreciate that Mr. Belzano qualified what we know and what we don't know. I also know that the enemy of good is perfect. But clearly, you should have, at least at the committee level, a substantive discussion to make a policy deterministic finding as to what the best approximation is. And I didn't see that presented in either the technical presentation of the gentleman from USGS or in the discussions among staff and council to date. And so I really want to flag that as something that should be carefully considered. And also, there's currently no information being provided to facilitate a framework and a benchmark for finding that standard. So again, I really think that in regards to what we know and what we don't know, there's a middle ground, which is perhaps anecdotal and extrapolation. We haven't had that dialogue yet. I would just like to leave the council with perhaps a handout on the small sector, but very large, of nature-related tourism in the state of New Jersey, knowing that Highlands is particularly important. I'd like you to note that wildlife-related recreation in the state is a $2.25 billion industry. I'd like you to note that if you look at freshwater fishing and saltwater fishing, it turns into a $3.9 billion industry. The number of jobs, yes, created is 37,000. There's over 1 million people that canoe in the state, over 1 million that engage in trail hiking. Would like to commend for specifically Morris County for developing that infrastructure to facilitate that important economic sector.
Thanks very much.
When you get old, you reduce the number of pages. Mayor Hudson, Borough of Opatcon. I want to thank Ross McDonald for coming to our last meeting. He was quite informative, and actually prior to him, Dante had been there. We had raised a question about some light industrial development on a stretch, and Ross said that the technical people had looked at that and were not optimistic. Can we put that in writing somehow, you know, so we know what that's based on? I'm not taking issue with it. I just want to how they reach that. My main concern is really about the authority that the commission has, and you have a letter in your handouts today which was addressed to John Eskelson and Eileen Swan, which addresses part of my concern, and what it speaks about is holes within the state plan, like the Highlands and Pinelands, Meadowlands. My concern is about the holes within the holes. Those are areas that are not preserved, but are within the Highlands, and that's basically the developed area, the Borough of Opatcon, and other communities. Who has jurisdiction there? And the more I hear the reports that are presented, the scarier it gets. Because so many of the things, such as that presentation, the pictophylactic, that's basically telling people if you could redevelop your town all over again, this is the way you should have done it. And that's kind of absurd for grown communities, but nonetheless. they all speak to the kind of development that ought to go on in these planning areas, and that's not your jurisdiction. And so what's scary to me is the more and more of these things come forward and someone else looks at them and says, well, hey, you know, in that plan, it says you can't have this there. Well, then it can't be there. And that's not your jurisdiction. And so, I mean, everybody's going to say, well, there's policy and so on. But it's scarier and scarier listening to the discussions that go on, what I see as the infringement into the planning areas, which is really a province of the municipalities or the state plan. In our case, there's the Sussex County Strategic Growth Plan, which is now before the state planning group, and however they will work that out. And so now on top of all of that is yours. And so who really comes up with the plan for my planning area? And that bothers me, and what I hear scares me. One of the things I would like you to consider on a different tack, and that is transfer of lands. I know you talked about TDRs, but we talk about the opt-in, somehow or other getting a wording for that that would allow communities to put in areas and take out other areas. Because the lines were drawn for geographic features. So you get down a road, that's a feature. But you know, the railroad track that's right next to it, or not very far from it, that's a feature also. And the line could have been drawn there. And a community such as ours might have some other areas which are much better for water recharge that we could put in if in exchange we were allowed to extract some of the others. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Maurice Macario, I live in Oakland, and my property's in Kinlan. The committee admitted, which we could understand, serving on committees myself in various capacities, cannot legislate or figure every contingency. One of the women admitted that this will be thought of in the future somewhere in additional considerations. But in the meantime, a lot of people are being hurt. And what has the gripe with a lot of people is that there's no appeal process to be heard on an individual basis. In my particular case, I'm in a development where there are houses across the street, houses behind me, houses to the left of me, houses to the right of me, road to 600. But it's in the Highlands Preservation Act. I can build a house, but I don't want to build a house. I'm looking to retire. I'm going to be 65 years old. I can't speculate on building a house. And I can't sell my lot to anybody because whoever I sell it to is not grandfathered in. So it's dead property. And there's no appeal process to say, yes, you live on Denise Drive in Kinlan, and the whole area is developed, but you're in the Highlands Preservation Act, so sometime in the future, we may address it. There needs to be an appeal process. And in fact, if my property is that restricted and really does impact, well, I have to live with it. But I'd like to have someone that I can just, at my own expense, maybe it costs a $5,000 application fee, that's okay with me. Maybe I have to have an engineering study, that's okay with me. I already went through wetlands and all that business. At least someone can say to me, say, you know, Doc, your property, if we build on it, people will not have water. Okay, fine. But there is nothing. There's nobody to tell me that. So all I ask is that when you do this legislation, let's have some type of a process where individuals don't have to wait until I'm dead and buried, and my grandchildren may have that opportunity when it's finally addressed. We need an appeal process now so people will not be hurt until this is all done, which was admitted by the committee that we're not going to be able to legislate for every contingency. So let's have an appeal. It's going to cost us a lot of money to go through that appeal. I'm willing to do it. And I'm willing to abide by whatever the committee or the appeal process says, if in fact it is. Anyway, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
name is Deborah Post, and before I start my formal comments, I would like to respond to this discussion of ecotourism and agritourism. My mother, well over 30 years ago, opened our orchards to the general public for a pick-your-own apple orchard. I believe she was the pioneer in this business in the state of New Jersey, long before the silly word agritourism was ever coined. I know what agritourism earns. I know how much debt my colleagues in the agritourism business have racked up. And I know how many farmers in the agritourism business have bailed themselves out of bankruptcy by farmland preserving. Please do not, for one minute, think that agritourism, ecotourism, and hiking trails is an economic base for the Highlands. That's absurd. I reviewed most of the Council's recent releases. The documents posted are largely generic. Many read before have little specific data relating to the Highlands, include maps generally available before August 2004, and may have been plagiarized from an Environmental Resources 101 textbook. I am mystified regarding how these releases get this council closer to a detailed, thoughtful, scientifically based regional master plan. Good luck. I brought with me today Mr. Chambers' map from the Star Ledger in the fall of 2004 that wonderfully depicts the corruption and political evil of the Highlands Act. I was struck by this map's similarity to the watershed map in a recent council release. Check it out. All the politically donated land is outside the watersheds, way outside the watersheds. Landowners with land in these non-watershed regions have lost their land equity value for no public purpose. Pure New Jersey. I think that's what the previous gentleman was addressing in a possibly more polite manner. A recent newspaper article entitled Minor Impact from Highlands Act, Star Ledger, Minor Impact from Highlands Act, is a model of disinformation, misinformation, and misunderstanding. This article, purportedly based on a council report, tells the public that because ratables have not dropped due to the Highlands Act, that no harm has been done. Ratables is a fake Highlands issue raised by municipalities and politicians in an attempt to siphon scarce funds into municipal coffers instead of to the true harmed parties, the landowners. The Highlands Act has zero impact on the tax assessed values of 95% of undeveloped acreage because the vast majority of Highlands open space is farmland assessed. Farmland assessed. There is absolutely no change in the tax assessed value of woodlands and farmland. To suggest otherwise is to display a true ignorance of the tax assessment process. And when we read council members playing into the myth of lost ratables, this council loses any semblance of intellectual integrity. Existing preservation area home prices will, of course, rise. Supply of preservation area housing is now static. Demand for preservation area housing continues to grow. The pricing curve clearly dictates that home prices in the preservation area will increase. Contrary to erroneous spin, the Highlands Act may increase total ratables. In fact, the preservation area, in my opinion, will evolve into a vast public park for the rich, with high ratables and low demand for educational services. The chairman of this council is quoted as saying, contrary to some people's fears, the sky is not falling. Well, Mr. Chairman, the sky has already fallen for the farmers and landowners who have lost $6 billion of land value. Net worths carefully guarded to pay for educations, grandchildren's medical needs, critical farm equipment, and of great importance, that retirement that you never need to worry about, have already been eviscerated. Your comment is callous, deceptive, demeaning, and evidences a total disregard for the duties with which the legislator charged this council, to wit, Section 2N, recognizing the need to provide just compensation to the owners of the land. Thank you.
Yes.
Julia Summers, Executive Director, New Jersey Highlands Coalition.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments for when you start considering policy as a result of the water data that is being developed. And I want to compliment you on the extensive data that is being developed. We've been taking a look at a lot of it and will continue to do so and provide you with our comments. I'm a watershed person. I came from a watershed association before I went to the Highlands Coalition. And I'd like to refer you to the stress map in which there are, in a number of cases, HUC 14s that are stressed. But above them, in the water, in the same watershed, there are HUC 14s that do not appear to be stressed. If you assume that those unstressed HUC 14s above the stressed HUC 14s have capacity, you're going to really seriously create a problem in the downstream HUC 14 that's already stressed. So I would urge you to consider any situation where you have a downstream HUC 14 that is stressed, consider all of that watershed upstream of there to be stressed. I apologize, that's my telephone ringing. The other major issue that I wanted to raise is we're looking at water capacity and water needs and economic growth issues for the Highlands, but we're not looking at all for that entire region of northern New Jersey for which the Highlands is the water supply. And I really do think that has to be, their needs have to be considered as well as you move forward with this RMP. Thank you very much.
My name is David Chope. I live in Long Valley. I was dismayed by Mr. Schreier's reaction to a sign which, to my mind, I thought the issue was well settled by the Supreme Court when they decided the Nazis could march in Cicero. This gentleman, whose name I don't even know, I doubt if he's a Nazi. He endeavored to express his First Amendment rights. Mr. Schreier didn't like it. I don't like a lot of things that Mr. Schreier does either, but you know what? I have to tolerate it until you crawl back into your enclave or die. So until that time, we'll have to tolerate each other.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I mean, I don't think any one of these members on this council are mean-spirited as some of the people that address this body. And I think if they're going to address this body, you know, we're all here to try and do what's best, have a little bit of decorum, a little bit of respect for the people that are sitting here volunteering their time to try and do what's best for all the people in the Highlands region.
As long as Mr.
Mrs. Post, I, in my heart, I can only speak for myself, I do have some concern for the landowners, but with your mean-spirited attitude, we will never, ever get anything accomplished with that type of behavior.
I wonder if we will get anything accomplished. I've read the Act. I know what it says. I know what its intent is. And you people are going down the path that is laid out to you by the Act. The Act is mean-spirited. The Act speaks hypocritically of compensation to landowners. The Act speaks hypocritically about you people identifying a list of property owners that are so badly affected that you're supposed to generate the list and compensate them. There's been no progress on this. I asked for this list and even very early on in the process, no progress. So, as mean-spirited, this Act is mean-spirited. And you people, almost all of you, with a few recent exceptions, were appointed by Governor What's-His-Name. Bask in the glory of that.
And don't own any land.
And if you do, it's not in the preservation area. We heard a preservation presentation again today, which puts the Highlands area as if it were an island, as if it were a self-contained entity. The only reason it's a self-contained entity is because a bunch of corrupt people down in Trenton drew some lines in some back room somewhere. I'm familiar with local politicians who have told me, mayors of towns, told me how the lines were drawn in their town. I know the process. Don't try and pretty it up. And what you're talking about almost exclusively here is groundwater. The surface water is collected and sold to the Germans at cost. The Germans mark it up. As a matter of fact, they're looking for a 23% price increase right now for water that is collected on our backs, sold by the state, the water supply authority, wherever he went, they and Habs went, at cost, and they make a profit on it. I own RWE stock. It's done very well. I wonder why. Because they have the state of New Jersey as their agent. I think I'll leave it at that.
I'm Robert Fry. I'm a farmer in Powhatan Township, and I'm also a watershed person, having been the founder of one of the founders of the Powhatan Creek Watershed Association. If the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act is really about water for the cities, perhaps the council should consider working toward reactivating the Tox Island Dam project on the Delaware River, as proposed in the 1960s, as a source of consumptive water use for the long-term future, rather than relying on aquifers within the fractured bedrock. And I'd like to have this become part of the minutes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Andy Drysdale. I'm trapped in the preservation area at 32 East Fox Chase Road, Chester Township, Morris County, New Jersey. Today I need to talk to you about wetlands, but first I want to tell you about an incident that occurred about a week ago in the late afternoon rush hour. My wife Lois and I were driving west on Route 24, also known as County Route 510 in Chester Township, near the intersection of Colby Farm Road, when we came upon a 10 to 12 inch snapping turtle traveling south across the lane of traffic. I have realized in retrospect that the turtle was leaving the planning area and was about to enter the preservation area. I stopped our car, and while I was searching for the button to turn on the hazard lights, Lois got out and stopped the eastbound traffic. I then got out of the car. At this point, the turtle had stopped in the middle of the road right on the preservation area line. We both attempted to get the turtle to continue his or her journey, but all it would do was snap at us. I found a stick of wood on the side of the road and tried to push it along with that. He or she would have none of that and continued to snap at us. By this time, the traffic was backed up for quite a distance in both directions. A person who had stopped down the road from us got out of his car and yelled, "Take him on!" The turtle grabbed the end of the stick, and I was able to drag him several feet into the preservation area. He or she then continued on into the preservation area, out of the road, and began climbing the grassy slope. This turtle had successfully crossed the road from one housing development into another without the use of any environmental rules created by the DEP. Cars were beginning to turn around and go the other way. We got in our car and continued on our way, and the backed up traffic began to flow again. As for the overrated wetlands, they still exist and are still being used as an excuse for large takings of land without compensation. When in Washington Township, the state wanted to build a road through some wetlands, they decided to build a wetland someplace else. This is total nonsense. To build a wetlands, they make the land less impervious. Most of the water that falls on wetlands runs off into streams and rivers. What is left just sits there and breeds mosquitoes until it evaporates or is washed away by additional rainfall. A majority of the Earth's surface is already covered by water, so that it is unlikely that we need the evaporation aspect. I believe that wetlands that have already been preserved and any so-called endangered species that may depend on them are no longer endangered. I am not opposed to the preservation of wetlands themselves if landowners are justly compensated for those easements, but the taking of 300-foot wide buffers is totally ridiculous and unnecessary. This abuse of power must be stopped. And more, as more unnecessary laws and rules are made, the cost to the taxpayers increases. We have just had a 1% increase in the sales tax. There will be more increases down the road unless we eliminate some of the unnecessary bureaucratic programs such as the Highlands Act and the oppressive rules put forth by the DEP. Please explain this to the governor, the legislator, the DEP, and the voters of the state of New Jersey. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Rick Henson. I live in the Califon area. I want to say hi to Dante, Stephen, Tim, Elizabeth, Tracy, Deborah, John, Jack, Kurt, Mimi, Glenn, and Janice. The Highlands Act has destroyed the rest of my life. I have no retirement. Do you people have a retirement? Do you? I guess you do. All right. To me, this isn't about water. It's about segregation through conservation. I'm all for saving land if the people get paid for it. There's got to be a better way than to devaluate, than to destroy these people's lives. This is like the Nazis, all right? I get this information to my Aunt Erica. She was in a camp. She told me, Rick, the bastards are back. There's got to be a better way, people. We got to compensate farmers. I don't care about me. Farmers, these people who have lived there for generations and have got nothing. And I'm not talking about a 30%, 70% value of their property. They should be paid 150% of what the fair market value of their property. Give these people the opportunity, a reverse mortgage. Let them live there for 20 to 30 years. After that, the state can have the property. But at least let these people have peace for the rest of their life. This is America, right? We're all in this together. We all pollute. Right? We're like a cancer on this earth. And what gives some people the right to take away other people and yell, hooray for me? It's wrong, people. It's wrong. There's got to be a better way. And I would like to talk to somebody, John, someday, in a common sense way of how we can obtain the land, compensate the farmers, and everybody is happy. Nobody's happy here. These people are devastated. I'm devastated. You know, I'm a person too. I'm like, Steve, you're a heck of a nice guy, and I don't even know you. Dante, you too. Tim, glad to meet you, sir. There's got to be a better way, okay? That's all I'm saying. Thank you.
My name is Bob Shandor. I live in Lopatcong Township near Phillipsburg, New Jersey. The biggest problem I see with the Highlands is the fact that you haven't compensated. You've taken the property from the people and you haven't compensated them. A true violation of the United States Constitution. I think you people are doing a lot of research here, but you should get back to the basics and correct the faults in the Highlands Act by compensating the owners. I have a suggestion that you propose to the legislature real estate transfer fee, perhaps about 2%. I'm buying some land in Pennsylvania, that's the fee rate over there, 2% of the selling price, and perhaps a water tax. And this is what you should be doing at this point, rather than hiring these people to do all this research that's already facts. You know, a lot of this work is already done. You're spending probably hundreds of thousands of dollars on this. Just get a recommendation from you people. Get it into the legislature. And have people pay for the compensation to the landowners here. And then you can move on with the Highlands Act. So that's my thoughts for today. Thank you.
Mr. Weingart?
Yes.
One thing I forgot to bring up. In both resolutions, you did not allow the public a comment period.
That is true. I apologize for that. And I'll go back now. Would anyone like the public to have any comment on our resolution to give the grant to the Borough of Lebanon? Any comment on our designation of ethics liaison? Yes, sir.
Perhaps your ethics liaison member should investigate the ethics of the Highlands Act.
Any other comments? I'll leave the resolution stand, but I apologize for not doing that. Any council members have comments?
I'm sorry, I heard that something from
Steve. Steve, Dante, looking at this project status of the regional master plan, I don't see anything for the economic development component listed here. Is it?
It's under the financial analysis.
Which I don't see here either. I apologize. Financial analysis at the end.
Yeah.
So that's economic development as part of financial analysis.
Well, yes. Reporting on economic growth opportunities is part of the financial analysis.
Okay. And then the second question was, we all received a letter from the DEP regarding their opinion that properties that are exempted from the Highlands Act provisions, the owners should have to record deed restrictions?
Yes. We discussed that at the Warren County Planning Board last month, and we're going to respond to
that. I'm concerned about that. You know, all of a sudden now, you know, very clearly the legislature identified components, people, properties that should be exempted from the Act, and it seems to me this is a backdoor, well, let's get them. In the minute of the Act, these people are supposed to be exempted, but who's going to bear the cost of including these deed restrictions on their deeds and titles? You know, it seems to me if again the intent of the Act is to serve the people of the state, then the people in the state should pay the expenses of placing a deed restriction so that they can memorialize that they only expanded the 25% of the existing houses and didn't exceed that. I don't like it. I don't like it. They can justify it all they like by executive orders, but I think it stinks.
The issue for members who didn't get a chance to see the letter, and I'm not going to speak to the financial part of it, but the issue of deed restriction is the issue of how to provide notice to someone who may purchase a property that there are different rights that come with it from someone who might have gotten grandfathered rights. So that's the context for what to do about it. As for DP's letter, I guess it speaks for itself. Mr. Sherman, if I could just give a couple of updates.
I don't think it's explaining rights. I think it's explaining what's been taken. You can look at it both ways. Is the glass half empty, half full, Dante? Let's be clear. It's not telling people what they have the right to do. It's telling them what they can't do.
It's
like when someone searches, if I want to buy a property, if when my title company searches the deed, if there's nothing in there, I would not perhaps know without reading the Highlands Act that there may be some limitations on my full use of that property. So it puts them on notice as a subsequent purchaser that there's an issue. As for how it happens, who pays for it, I'm not speaking to that, but on the issue of if members didn't see why that issue is out there, is to provide notice to subsequent purchasers.
But don't we need to speak to that? I mean, is it now the policy of the state of New Jersey that every landowner in the preservation area now has to have new deed restrictions placed upon their deeds?
If they're going to get a letter. If they get the letter from the DEP, that's going to be
I read that letter right, Debbie, it said anybody, you know, you put a swimming pool in, that's going to trigger it. As soon as you do something, you put a deck on, you know, that's going to trigger. I mean, you're shaking head. But
I don't think that's what the letter says. I think the letter.
And what is it?
But I think it pertains, as Dante said, to
people, it doesn't pertain to all the exemptions in the Act, which don't offer it. It pertains to the exemptions in which there's some additional development that was allowed on that lot. And so I think Dante articulated what the DEP's reason on what he released.
But a swimming pool is development. A deck is development. Those are forms of impervious coverage. And you're limited to that impervious coverage. I mean, that triggers it.
Well, I think since none of us, to the best of my knowledge, were involved in that letter or the policy behind it, maybe we should get some of the DEP.
Yeah, I was going to offer we could gather some information.
But then ultimately, aren't we going to need a policy? I mean, isn't that going to have to be part of the regional master plan? I mean, we're going to have to, at some point, have a voice in this.
Well, we have not been proposing such a thing, or it hasn't been part of, excuse me, our calculus. I would assume if the department's sending a letter, it's because it's part of their independent regulatory authority, they're considering or are doing this, but I can ask staff to get more information and report back to you on what it is and what the basis is.
Let me just add that this issue came up some months ago, and our chief counsel just walked in to bring them up to speed. We're talking about the letters that the DEP, the deed restrictions the DEP is requiring.
Right.
And I know I've had some conversations with Tom about this, because what precipitated it in Warren County was a letter specific to a landowner, or several letters specific to a landowner. Dave Deck just left, he could have filled in, but that were overly restrictive. You're talking about the very issue. I understand what you're saying, but I know Tom had begun to look at this and had made some comments. He might have something to share now, he may want to defer to later, but I know he's done some work on this.
Maybe I could do just a quick, I think I know the issue, which is, DEP is requiring deed restrictions as part of some of the HAD exemption determinations. And it goes to a New Jersey Supreme Court case, which requires for proper notice for subsequent owners that some type of deed notice be in there. So I think the law is clear that deed notice is a proper mechanism. The question, to go to your point, is the deed restriction being put in on properties overly stringent or not? And I think it's fair to say that it should be consistent with whatever the exemption is.
You didn't hear Kurt's comment was who should be paying for this and what triggered it. It's that HAD determination triggers it.
Right, the HAD determination itself, once DEP issues an exemption, as the law of the state would dictate that proper notice should be put in deeds, and the property owner would have the obligation to put that deed restriction and that notice.
I think we need to be very cognizant of how this affects the daily lives of people who live in the Highlands Preservation Area. I'm the only one here. And I'm telling you, you go to Town Hall. I went to Town Hall the other day just to get a permit to put in an electric service. But I put in 8 electric services in my 25 years of having a business. Well, now I had to get a zoning clearance. Why? Because I was going to put an outside light. I've got 365 acres and only adjoining lots. But they're worried that the light might be too big and shine on my donkeys. My point is that these people in municipal, they cover themselves in every which way, and it's easier to say no than to say yes. And every person who comes in and has a clear exemption is going to say, well, you better get a clearance over here, you better get a clearance over there. And pretty soon everybody's going to end up with these HADs, and then everybody's going to have deed restrictions. And who's going to pay for all this? These are the people that were supposed to be left pretty much untouched by this, so that they could just sort of live their lives in the Highlands Preservation Area. And all of a sudden now there's another layer of bureaucracy they have to deal with just to live simple lives. And it's not supposed to be this way.
Debbie.
Okay, I have a couple items here that were mainly follow-up from previous meetings. And I know I'm looking at the time here. I'm not looking for some big discussion on this. It's really to just keep some matters alive and keep them forward. One is there's two letters in our packet this week, letters that were sent, I guess it was under Dante's signature, to OSG, for a sort of a procedural standpoint. Did any of our subcommittees review those before they went out? Because they're sort of policy, some of it is technical comments, some of it's beyond that. And do we still, because we changed the structure of some of the subcommittees, do we have a subcommittee that this would be run by?
Well, plan development, I mean, could do it arguably, or maybe, you could put it various places. What we did was we spoke with the chairman to review the general comments. And there's going to be a whole process that's going to follow, and a lot of it is going to deal with issues that we are going to discuss with members of the council, such as how our plan fits into the state plan and the processes. So in the meantime, based on the direction of this body last time, we made sure that we had the opportunity to provide comments, which we did. We have secured a process where we have an ability on an ongoing basis to provide information once our draft regional master plan is out. So we've secured the ability of this body to have a meaningful opportunity. And we've also put put the OSG and SBC on notice that there's some issues that are going to impinge on or affect this body's ability to do its plan in its jurisdiction, and so we have issues that are going to need to be resolved. At the point when we get to the substance of those or those decisions are going to be made, we can clearly run them back through the chairman or through the relevant committee. But to date, that's been the process.
Yeah, and I think so. It just so happened, but we usually meet more frequently, but one of these letters went out really a month ago, and we just got them this week. I think it'd be a better idea, particularly in the age of technology, that you copy counsel on these kinds of things at the time. I don't think we need to see every piece of correspondence that goes out, but some of these where we may get calls about them and we need to be aware of it, I would ask that we try and do that and think about following up on that one. At the last council meeting, there was an issue about if a municipality goes for plan endorsement and prior to the regional master plan, the whole issue of, well, what do they conform to and what does that do to their ability to obtain a legal shield in the future? I'm bringing it up. Tom wasn't at the meeting last time, and I think this is under his purview. I think we want to, at some point, get a review of that so we know. That relates to all of these issues as well. Also, Tracy had requested some sort of written assurance from OSG relative to the timing of Sussex plan endorsement. I didn't see anything. Did we get anything back from OSG in response to any of these things or give us a timetable?
It was the subject of the PIC yesterday at OSG, and it's ongoing discussion. They have a draft document which addresses the issue, and it's still not in final form.
Okay. Also, at the last meeting, Bob Bezik from Somerset County had raised the issue of the MOAs that have not yet been finalized. Was that discussed yesterday? Also, or would that be at the whole plant? Would that be at the whole SBC meeting?
That's a sub-issue of the coordination between OSG and.
Because I was asked about it by two people in the last month, and I want to make sure we have some sort of answer for them. And last but not least, and this is some of this is because we haven't had a subcommittee meeting, is we were going to do an RFP for outsourcing the physical production of the plan. Did we do that?
Yeah, that's on the website. Yeah.
It is? Okay, so we got it out there, so we need to put that on the agenda for the next finance subcommittee meeting, because that
right.
was actually the next step. We didn't have one, understandably, which is fine. That's it.
I'd like to congratulate Janice, who is becoming the acting director of the Division on Women in the Department of Community Affairs, which apparently does not require that she leave the Highlands Council. So.
We're not letting you go.
Right.
I'll still be here.
Right. Congratulations. Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of things, if I could. One was the issue sort of mentioned today. Someone who owns vacant land and sells it to someone, the person who buys it may not have the same rights as someone who is grandfathered, but that person still is able to avail themselves of an exemption under the statute for putting a single family dwelling in and with certain limitations so that the members of the public are aware that that is the case. Also, in terms of funding sources, so that everyone's aware, this council in the past have proposed research into additional funding mechanisms for preservation in the context of a water tax and in other contexts, and continues to support renewal of the Garden State Preservation Trust to make sure that there's adequate funding for preservation. And other than to thank Otto for his preservation, for his work on the project that creates new cutting-edge science, it's a material advancement in the plan, and we appreciate USGS's efforts in doing that.
Just real quick, only to Debbie's question that in terms of those MOUs, I think that's paramount that issue get resolved. And I can remember almost a year ago, the former executive director, and I believe Janice accompanied us, and former council member Spinelli. We went to Trenton, and then we had that one meeting, and that was a topic of discussion then, and it's never been raised again formally amongst the committee. And as we move forward, this whole plan is never going to get off the dime if those MOUs are not ironclad amongst all these agencies. You could talk about this harmonizing till the cows come home, but I know you're going to get resistance amongst those agencies. And, you know, and I'm not shooting holes in science, but I think we should be spending more effort on those MOUs. Otherwise, this thing is going to go nowhere.
I concur. Glenn, I began the discussion
and again,
January of 2005. So.
I don't want to start the whole discussion now. It's late in the day, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, just so folks know the context, those discussions have not ended. It's not that they're on the back burner or the back shelf, but there have been some substantial changes. You know, one, for example, is that some of the folks you mentioned, Ben Spinelli and Eileen Swan, are now down at OSG, and part of what that means in a very positive sense to the entire state is that they are revisiting some policies that have been in effect there in an effort to improve them and to make sure that the coordination works. Some of the examples include, right now, OSG is considering whether they should treat our regional plan differently than they treat other county plans. It's an interesting issue because, obviously, county plans add a lot in terms of regional data and planning, but they don't, for example, have as much authority over local municipalities to control decision-making. And in some cases, like with our preservation area or with the Meadowlands, you know, the State Planning Commission doesn't really have jurisdiction. The jurisdiction is here. And so it's not that the discussions over those issues have stopped. It's that the discussions have continued and have gone some into the very specific substance that we're going to need to resolve in order to make sure that we have a coordinated process. And to that end, you know, we have been encouraging staff down there to think about how the process for looking at endorsement of our plan eventually ought to fit into the process. How should our good science inform what the state plan is doing? How our jurisdiction in the preservation area needs to be respected. And so these discussions, I think, necessarily have to be ongoing in order for us to do them effectively. So we understand the point that they need to be resolved, but in terms of why they are there, it's in part because of some changes structurally down there, but mostly because we really need this to work effectively, and we're getting closer to that, and we'll be able to brief the council as we go forward.
But Don, I'm sorry, John. Are you, different subject, are you legislative liaison? Is that sort of your hat that you wear here, or do
yes.
you have something?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time that we, John and Dante, I think we need a meeting with the governor. You know, this, we are, that turtle that was on 24 is faster than the speed of getting dedicated funding to pay for preservation up here. And I think we really need to have a sit down with Governor Corzine and say, look, you know we're never going to go anywhere if there's not a funding mechanism in place to make something happen. And if he was able to just push through a 1%, you know, another 1% increase in the sales tax, why can't we push through a water tax for the people who are drinking the water that is being generated up here in the Highlands? I think he needs to hear this message. And well, I think it's our job as council members to bring him this message.
Well, I'm not sure if you're here for the first part of the meeting, but I was able to report that the administration in the next 60 days is coming up with decisions on how to move forward. And in that context, they are aware from us, the administration are aware of, from us, that one, we continue to maintain strong support and necessity for adequate funding. We've supported the water tax, and we'd like that favorably considered. We would like the Garden State Preservation Trust renewed with adequate funding and with an ability to make sure that the funds come back to the Highlands, which is the same kind of caveat we had for the water bill. If there are particular things that you think we ought to add to the list. Like I say, the next 60 days is a time that's been marked out by the administration for deciding what and how to proceed. The administration has specifically asked not only for the what, but the how in terms of, you know, the strategies. Who ought to be part of the process, who ought to help developing the development of what happens, and then who would, you know, go to the towns and get their support, because it's a whole, you know, I'll call it a campaign, that's my word, not theirs, to once you have something which we would like to advance, how we get the towns and the counties motivated and other stakeholders as well, so that we all can be successful in making sure that there's adequate funding for another 10 years like we did with GSPT.
That's all fine, but we need to meet with the governor.
Just
hear me out, John. The State Board of Ag, you know, Farm Bureau already had a sit down with Governor Burzine. You know, we're a body appointed by the previous governor, but I mean, we're direct appointment. We are part of the executive branch. And I think we can't underestimate the impact that we as individual council members can have speaking to him. Human relationships are important. This man, we need to have some face time with him, even if it's 20 minutes. He needs to hear the message, and I think it's critical. We can talk to aides all we want, but we need to, I think it's critical that we push for, we'll all go to Trenton. Now, I'll donate my gas time, you know, to go down there, but I really think we need to sit with him and even just for 20 minutes, and just tell them what's happening up here.
I agree with you, and I think the time now that the budget situation over, it's time for us to renew the efforts that were being driven, Kurt, by the Land Preservation Subcommittee, and I think we need to schedule a meeting, and we need to, if we're supposed to provide, if that's the status of decisions are going to be made in 60 days, then we better hurry up and make some specific proposals within that time frame. No sense getting involved after that point when the decisions are already made. Are you on that subcommittee? Are you on the Land Preservation Subcommittee? I think so. Let's get a meeting organized and come up with some very specific. And to the gentleman who spoke earlier, he raised some interesting points that put on the table for discussion.
We can explore that. I assume we can't. It would have to be less than a quorum to meet with the governor, but we could do that one way or another.
I heard there were some meetings with a quorum with the governor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. As it's your time.
Right, yes, right. Okay. So we can explore it. I think that's a good idea. Other comments?
I would support both those ideas. Kurt, I think you're right. I mean, I think on a purely political basis, we're a constituency, and I think on the eve of crunch time on this plan, it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a discussion about all the things that are going on. I think it'll be fun to see what the agenda becomes and how we, you know, put that together ourselves for the limited time we have with them. I would also, just to echo Glenn's thought, you know, I think it is important, given the stuff that's played out in terms of the strategic plans, the road plans that are out there, plan endorsement, that we nail down how that stuff's going to work. At least get it to a point where there's something in front of us that we can include in our conversations about the implementation of the RMP. I think it's good that's going on, and yes, I recognize that the new administration is taking things in a somewhat different direction, but my experience in the past with the State Planning Commission is that that's interminable, and I think we do need to nail that down, because there is a statutory obligation to submit this plan to them for consideration, so we should put that on the medium-term track, at least.
Not to undermine your suggestion at all, Kurt, but I mean, Lisa Jackson, as Commissioner of DEP and the person the governor has designated to deal with these issues, has been very available to Dante and the staff and to me when I want to talk to her as well. But we can still push it. We have a motion to adjourn?
So much.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye. Yeah. Get that bag in Mexico? No? Oh, yeah. Cool.
There, how are you?
Oh, good.
Well, good luck in your new career. That'll be fun.
Mr. Brinehart.
Look at it, they were not encouraged.